Good morning. The House State Administration Committee will now come to order. Will the clerk please call the roll?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Vice Chair Phelan?
Here.
Vice Chair Cordham?
Excused.
Representative Baum?
Here.
Representative Bertolio?
Here.
Representative Brockman?
Excused.
Representative Frazier?
Excused.
Representative Green?
Excused.
Representative Perry?
Excused.
Representative Rexton?
Here.
Representative Runningwolf?
Here.
Representative F. Smith?
Here.
Representative Sprunger?
Here.
Representative Staffman?
Here.
Representative Walsh?
Here.
Representative Weatherwax?
Excused.
Representative Yakowicz?
Present.
Representative Worth?
Here.
Chair Dooling?
Here. Good morning, everyone. A few announcements before we get started. Please silence your cell phones. If you must take a call, please step outside of the committee room. If you wish to give testimony, please sign at the door, providing your name and affiliation, if any. Please note that the information in your testimony is a public record. The following bills have been scheduled today: House Bill 196, 190, and 199. We will now hear House Bill 196, sponsored by Representative Helgard.
Good morning. I'm Representative Lynn Helgard, House District 97, which runs from Lolo up the Big Flat Mullen Road out to Petty Creek. I'm here to present on House Bill 97. I was asked by Montana citizens involved with voter integrity projects across Montana to bring this bill forward. The bill's quite simple. The voters of Montana are requesting that we put language removed in 13-15-101 in 2019. We put it back into statute. This will require election administrators to reinstate the protocols and procedures they used prior to the 2020 election and not adjourn once they start counting ballots on election day. When listening to the 2019 hearing, the problem expressed was the volume of absentee ballots. We are not asking to remove the three business days they have to prep the absentee ballots before election day. 13-13-241, Section 7, Subsection A, allows them to start counting absentee ballots the day before election day. With these two allowances, we do not believe we are asking too much of our election offices. I stand for questions, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative. We'll now hear from proponents.
Morning, Madam Chair, and committee members. I'm Dana Corson, C-O-R-S-O-N, Montana Secretary of State's Office, Director of Elections. My interest in this bill is for the voters and the public and the media. The one thing that voters expect on election day after they vote are election results. On election night, until the ballots have been counted, the timely and regularly updated election results that are available to the candidates, the public, and the media promotes confidence in the election process, as well as providing some much-needed information as to how many ballots have been counted and in which precincts, which have been completed. They need to know about the winners and losers in each race and if there's any potential recounts, and if the county has completed all of the ballots that were cast on election day. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Corson. Any other proponents?
Good morning. I'm Loy Chvilicek, L-O-Y-C-H-V-I-L-I-C-E-K. Good morning, Chairman Dooling and all you committee members. I'm a retired farm wife from northern Montana, a mother of six children, and I reside in Lewis and Clark County. House Bill 196, MCA 13-15-101, isn't being followed by election clerks in my county. Our judge forms that are now requesting that the judges only reconcile the number of ballots to the number of voters, and not given the proper legal form for them to record the cast votes given to each candidate and proposition. I agree with House Bill 196 as amended, but would recommend that a penalty be added to follow MCA 457-208. The handouts that I've given you today are related to this bill in that there are federal and state laws that are questionable also, but more on that later. Page one of your handouts, ES&S admits that some of their parts are made in China. The governor put out an order requesting the state employees delete the app of TikTok. The sheriff had to remove all the cameras in this county because they had China parts in them. But somehow our voting machines can keep the China parts. Page two of your packets, the state certification of the machines by the Secretary of State. Please read what is not being certified. The Secretary of State, county commissioners, election administrators, and county clerks all certified my vote on these machines. My washer and dryer have a better warranty and guarantee than these machines do. Page three reviews the findings of Mark Cook and others in their discoveries in Mesa County, Colorado. Granted, this machine they reviewed was a Dominion machine, not an ES&S. But according to DEFCON, all machines are capable of being hacked. Page four is Ben Cotton's affidavit from Antrim, Michigan. He's a cybersecurity.
Representative?
A point of order. I don't want to interrupt here, but what we need to do is keep the discussion on the bill that's in front of us currently. And as other bills come through and we talk about election integrity and those type of things, we'd appreciate your comments and information at that time.
Thank you.
So, Ms. Deloy, I can't, how do you pronounce your last name?
That's fine.
Can you pronounce your last name and respell it for us, please?
Chvilacek.
Chvilacek.
Okay. C-H-V as in Victor. I-L-I-C-E-K.
Okay, so Mrs. Chvilacek, I have a quick question for you. You said you supported this bill, but with an amendment, so technically that means you would be an opponent of this bill? You'd be an opponent of this bill?
No, I support this bill.
Okay. So if you would continue your testimony based on this bill, and we do have your handouts, and we can read those. Okay.
I'm new to all this, so
I know,
please
I know.
Excuse me. I think that basically says it. I just want to reiterate that this is not a Republican or Democrat issue. This is an issue of saving our country. Thank you.
Thank you. And the handouts that you provided us will be made part of this bill or part of our packet for the bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other proponents?
Good morning, Madam Chair and representatives on this committee. My name is Lisa Bennett. That's two N's and two T's. I'm from Carbon County. I wanted to start with the fact that in Carbon County, the video equipment where everything is being counted was black screened. What that means is they put a black film over it so you can't see what's happening. Our county commissioners and our county clerks all have keys to that office. They can go in at any time. If a vote is stopped to be resumed later, that means that citizens, poll watchers, judges are gone from that building. However, all the county people still have access to that building, all have access to those ballots overnight.
Ma'am.
Currently, our ballots...
Ma'am?
Yes.
Again, my apologies for interrupting, but we need to keep our proponents or our testimony based on the bill.
It is. It's to not stop counting. So this is all completely relevant. Because if you stop the counting, citizens have to leave and can't witness the security of those ballots. But the county people have keys and access to those ballots when there's no citizen there for oversight. So this is completely relevant. The reason why we don't stop counting is because the citizen judges and poll watchers are allowed to be there as counting continues. As soon as the counting stops, the building is supposedly secured, citizens are removed from the process completely. However, the government officials still have complete access to the building and those ballots with no citizen oversight. And I have testimony from our election administrator as well as our county clerk in Carbon County that they do come in hours early before the judges do, sometimes 6 a.m. or earlier. So without citizen oversight, you've got county people that have access to those ballots. How is that relevant? There is the possibility that ballots are sorted for undervotes. Possibility. I'm not accusing anyone of anything. And with those undervotes, because there is no none of the above button or to fill in or square or circle to fill in, you have the possibility of those sorted ballots being filled in and no one would know any different because the ballot chain of custody is broken without citizen oversight. So I'm a proponent of this bill because we need to make sure that we have citizens overseeing our government. Just like any other business, you have good people in positions, but you also could have nefarious characters that are in a position to do something. So I support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bennett. Any other proponents in the room? Any other proponents?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I appreciate being here, and I support this bill.
Can you please state your name and spell your last name, please?
Elizabeth Hale, H-A-L-E. I've been involved in election counting, the vote counting around here in Helena, and I see we have some concerns, so I think this would help solve some of our problems. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hale. I appreciate that. Any other proponents in the room? Any proponents online?
No, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any opponents in the room?
Madam Chair Dooling, members of the committee, my name is Keegan Medrano. That's M-E-D-R-A-N-O, and I'm here representing the American Civil Liberties Union of Montana, based in Missoula, Montana. We urge a no vote on HB 196, which would undo the bipartisan SB 162 from 2019, which some of the very members of this committee voted in support of. By reamending that any vote count must, quote, continue without adjournment until it is completed, and the result must be publicly declared, end quote. HB 196 would unduly shift burden on the dutiful election workers of Montana by compelling that the vote counting occur without break during a period of dramatic population growth of nearly 20,000 people, or 1.7% from July 2020 to July 2021, while Montana's registered voter count reaches over 752,000, with 81% turnout during the 2020 general election, and with inflamed anxiety about election security and increasing tension and threats of violence towards election workers, including aggressive leering and menacing. There are many instances of this happening, including in Cascade County. While election administrators struggle to robustly staff their offices with volunteers and employees within this maelstrom of angst and fear. It is in this environment that HB 196 thrusts onto our election administrators and workers this reamended language. It is untenable to ask election administrators and workers to count these ever-increasing ballots without break or respite. After the passage of the bipartisan SB 162, Montana's elections did not become immediately broken or full of fraud. Montana's election administrators and workers continue to complete their essential roles in our communities and in our body politic to reflect back the will of Montana voters. And with that, we urge a no vote on HB 196. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Medrano.
And Chair Dooling, may I be excused? I have another testimony to give.
I think he has a question for you, so I would suggest you stay.
Certainly. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other opponents in the room?
Morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jennifer Hensley, H-E-N-S as in Sam, L-E-Y. Jennifer spelled traditionally. I stand before you this morning on behalf of the County of Missoula, and we do respectfully oppose this bill for some of the same reasons previous opponent mentioned, but specifically practicality. Think about the evening of election night when returns come in and you want folks as prepared and as rested as possible to count all of those under all of the protections that are in place. If this bill were to go through, that early counting the day before the election would not be able to happen. And therefore, we probably won't get results until Wednesday or Thursday. That is not something the County of Missoula wants to provide. It's something that I do want to lay out for the committee as a potential consequence of this bill. We do support the 2019 legislation. It has a lot of safeguards in. I have it right here. I'm happy to forward it to members. The last vote on that bill when it went through the Senate after amendments was 41-9. So this was not a controversial bill 4 years ago. Many members of this delegation cast votes on it. So I would encourage you to take a look at that. Let the process work. Let these election administrators do their job. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hensley. Are there any other opponents in the room? Are there any opponents online?
Yes, Madam Chair. We have Debbie Pearson.
Thank you. Ms. Pearson, can you state your name and spell your last name, please? Go ahead, please. Ms. Pearson, are you there? Ms. Hansen, can you tell if she's having difficulties?
Can you hear me?
There she is.
I can hear you now.
Okay, great. So my name is Debbie Pearson, last name spelled P-I-E-R-S-O-N, first name Debbie, D-E-B-B-I-E. I'm the clerk and recorder and election administrator for Flathead County. And Madam Chair Dooling and members of the committee, I just want to share some concerns from the perspective of an election administrator. We used to do the count without ceasing. I can tell you sometimes we worked 30 to 40 hours without a break, without sleep, and that was for elections that there weren't even any concerns with. I'm not sure that everybody understands that it's not just as simple as tabulating the results, but whenever there is something that needs to go past the resolution board for resolution, that is also part of the process. So we can have the lion's share of our ballots counted, I think, in just about any county by midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning. But your resolution boards are still working to resolve any ballots that are of question. That's their job. They get to see if they can determine the voter intent. So your count board is waiting for all that process to happen to be able to count the end of the ballots. The other thing that I would bring to your attention is provisional ballots aren't counted until the following Monday as part of practice as well. So realistically, we are releasing results. Usually, we release results, I know in Flathead County, sometime after 8 o'clock when the polls close. Then we release again, usually closer to midnight, and then do a final release when we do decide to close things down for the evening. It's just good practice. People get fatigued. It's difficult to find people that are willing to work all night long and into the next day. We have had to do it. And again, that's been on elections that there weren't even any challenges. That was just the volume that we were trying to process through all the steps that are required. So I would encourage everybody to think about those things when they're considering this. Fatigue is a problem, and it can create issues with accuracy in the processes. And I know that there hasn't been, or there was the discussion that this does not include the Monday prior to election day, which is when we're allowed to start the count, which I'm not sure that I understand. Of course, that was put into place so that we had additional time to be able to process the volume of ballots coming in. And I know in Flathead County, we typically count from anywhere from 7, 8, 9 a.m. through 5 o'clock p.m. Then it breaks until the following morning. So again, that's a process that the count starts. There's a break, so I'm not sure if the request is to begin counting the day before, and then everybody has to stay there for the next 48 plus hours without ceasing. But that's entirely unrealistic. So I would just encourage that consideration on the members' behalf. The other thing is, I know again in Flathead County, we do have ingress and egress under camera where our count area is happening, and we also have 24/7 law enforcement surveillance in the building. So I think there are steps that could be made to ensure security or a log that's happening if there's people coming into the building. Some of that access is just required for us to be able to do the jobs that we've been sworn to do.
Thank you, Ms. Pearson. Are there any other opponents online?
Yes, Madam Chair. Next, we have Eric Semerad.
Mr. Semerad?
Yes, thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Please state your name and spell your last name and your affiliation, please.
Thank you. I'm Eric Semerad, Gallatin County Clerk and Recorder and Election Administrator. And I am speaking on behalf of my office here in Gallatin County.
Mr. Semerad, please spell your last name.
It's Eric with a C and S-E-M-E-R-A-D.
Thank you.
So, Madam Chair and committee members, I'm just going to talk a little bit about this past election in November and kind of what the atmosphere is here in Gallatin County regarding hiring and dealing with staffing working elections. So in November, we of course started counting on Monday, and we began counting mid-morning, Monday morning, and continued on through 5 o'clock on Monday evening, and then restarted counting again on Tuesday morning. And, you know, really the big thing that mostly affected the length of time for this particular election was that we received over 10,000 absentee ballots hand-delivered to us on Election Day. And those are ballots coming from the polls, so they don't even get to us until 9, 10, 11 o'clock at night on Election Day. And as you know, those have to go through a very lengthy verification process. Those ballots all have to be all sorted into batches by ballot style. You know, usually that's by precinct. And then they have to be receipted into the system and in those batches, and then they are verified in those batches. And then after verification, they go to boards of election workers that open those ballots, and they first reconcile and open the affirmation envelopes, the outside envelopes. Then they reconcile and open the inside envelopes, the secrecy envelopes, and separate the ballots from them and flatten those ballots to be prepared to count. And they go to the counting board, and they are run through the machine. And then, as was discussed earlier, some of those have to be they can't be run through the machine. So because they are damaged or there's overvotes on them, and so those have to go to a resolution board that will be working with those ballots that have to be resolved. And so that whole entire process is very, very lengthy, and it's not just running the ballots through a machine. That is a very small part of the process. So for us in large counties, you know, just that process for those absentee ballots received on Election Day, it took 24 more hours, more than 24 hours, for us to do that process. And so it's absolutely necessary for large counties like Gallatin County to have the option to begin counting on Mondays and to continue on. And we start early on Tuesday. You know, we're not counting at 8 o'clock on Tuesday morning, but we are working because the polls are open. We come in at 5 a.m. on election day to be prepared for the judges that are all arriving at the polls to set up. We have to be answering their questions. And I'm talking about our regular election office staff. These are the more experienced people. We can have some temporary election workers do some of this work, but it takes training to be able to do that. And so these people, the full-time election staff that are here year-round, those are the people that have to be here. And then we're working on through the day until late at night. This particular election, we counted through until about 2:30 Wednesday morning. And, historically, we have worked through the night, as Ms. Pearson stated earlier. We've done that. But we knew that this was going to be a very lengthy count because of all those absentee ballots. It just really is not humane to expect the people that are the backbone of our election department here to have to work through all of that without a break. We worked Monday. And just remember, leading up to an election, we work all weekend long. And the weeks leading up, it's literally 7 days a week for weeks leading up to the election. And it's going to be 7 days a week after the election because we received so many provisional ballots from the polls and, operating here at the office. We had over 1,800 provisional ballots that were cast on election day. So those all have to be sorted out on the Wednesday as well. So, and then those have to be all verified. And that takes the entire weekend after. So we're weeks at a time working long hours and then expected to also work what ended up being 40 hours of counting from Tuesday, starting Tuesday morning through about 12:45 a.m. on Thursday morning. And during that time, we released results after 8 p.m. On election day. And we released results also at 2:45 in the morning, Wednesday morning. That's after we stopped the count. Then my staff went, we shut everything down. We moved the tabulators and all the ballots into our vault, locked it up, and went home and got about 3 hours of sleep. And we're back in the office by 8 a.m. to restart the count and all these processes that I described to you earlier. Then on Wednesday, we released more results at around 5:30 on Wednesday evening. And then again, the final results were submitted to the Secretary of State at 12:45 a.m. Thursday morning. This is, if we had to go straight through, that would be about 40 hours straight on top of all that other time that we are working. And the hard part about this is, We have so many people that want to help. We really do. Lots of people signed up to be election judges, work at the polls, to help here in the office, opening and sorting ballots, doing all those processes. We had big crews of those people. But when it comes to 2 a.m. in the morning, those same people are not really willing to stay around. And so my crew here is at the end of their capabilities. And there just isn't those temporary workers to be able to support the processes that we have to do, because it's counting isn't just standing at a machine feeding ballots in. You know, that just takes, like, you know, two people. But the whole process, you know, we have probably about 70, 80 people working here at the courthouse over the period of these days of the election. You know, election's just not a day.
Mr. Semrad?
A couple of days.
Mr. Semrad?
Yes.
I appreciate your testimony. Can we get you to wrap it up a little bit, please?
Sure. I'll make one more point, which is the staffing part. And that's I've had 200% turnover in my staff over a little bit over a year. It's very difficult hiring here in Gallatin County. The pay is not commensurate with the work. And so it's difficult to even get people to do this work. And there's other things about elections that are turning people off to it. So I would ask, please, that you vote against this bill. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any other opponents online?
Yes, Madam Chair. Next is Regina Plettenberg.
Ms. Plettenberg.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Regina Plettenberg, P-L-E-T-T-E-N-B-E-R-G, and I'm here on behalf of the Montana Association of Clerk and Recorders. As you heard from prior testimony of the clerks from our larger counties, this is a very important emotional issue. And you can go back and listen to the testimony from 2019. It's all about the same as what you just heard. I listen to the proponents, and I do understand the need for timely results. I think we all do, and the security concerns. And so I'm just maybe hoping that there is a way without just completely undoing what was done, maybe working with the clerks, because as you can hear, a lot of times people think the answer is just hire more people. I've heard, you know, do like hospitals where they, you know, run 24/7, but we're not really designed like that in election offices. I mean, we just don't have the trained staff to do that. And I think that is really what this comes down to. It is great to have temps and volunteers that come in, and we value them more than I can tell you. But you've got to have trained people for oversight. And I think that's what we're really short on, because as both Mr. Semrad and Ms. Pearson talked about, you know, we just have so much trained staff, and we are spread out the days building up to the election. You know, so the Monday before, of course, is close of late registration, close of absentee, and then and so we're busy on that Monday and spread out. And then we're, of course, very spread out on Tuesday, as you can imagine. So this, I don't know if there's something we can work on to assure people's concerns regarding the security practice, and work with the clerks, but ease people's concerns surrounding the process. So with that, thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Plettenberg. On to, or any more opponents online?
No, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Hansen. Informational witnesses. Informational witnesses in the room, online?
No, Madam Chair.
Okay. Questions from the committee? Vice Chair Phelan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This would be for Mr. Medrano, is it?
Chair Dooling, Vice Chair Phelan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Medrano, are you familiar with the election that happened in France last year?
No, sir.
They hand counted 60 million votes and were done by midnight. And I don't know if you are familiar with what happened in Florida, but the governor had given a order that they would be done by midnight, or they would be paying for the election themselves, that county would. And they were, you know, a much bigger state than ours. France, a much bigger country than the state of Montana. and they were all done by midnight. So I really believe that it can be done. And so what is your thoughts?
Chair Dooling, Vice Chair Phelan, respectfully, France and frankly Florida are vastly different than Montana, as you have noted. And I think that we have heard from the election administrators that the staffing concerns, the concerns about the toxicity around our elections and election security has made this tenuous and difficult. And I don't think we see those narratives present, I can't speak entirely, but I don't think we see those narratives present in France in the same way as we do in the United States. And so I would defer to the election administrators who spoke, I think, frankly and openly about the many barriers that are existing for them to count votes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Vice Chair. Mr. Medrano, Representative Sprunger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This question is for the sponsor.
Representative Sprunger, Representative Hellegard.
Madam Chair, Representative Sprunger.
Madam Chair, Representative Hellegard, thank you so much for your concern around election integrity. I'm trying to understand sort of the, as you are thinking about this bill, can you help me understand the primary thrust of concern? Is it, as some of your proponents shared, maybe the lack of security that they have identified or that they're concerned about, or is it an expedient count on the votes?
Madam Chair, I would, Representative Sprunger, the concerns are, one, the security. We've seen from the national news that, as Mr. Corson said at the 2019 hearing, when they stop counting, that's when people appear to be fiddling with things. So that goes to the public's perception that if the public isn't there to oversee the whole process, that nefarious things might occur. So the other thing is when it takes days and days to get the results, well, then people start questioning the results themselves, and it leads to the contention that the prior speaker spoke about.
A follow-up, Madam Chair? Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative. That's really illuminating. So one thing, and I appreciate the concerns of the proponents. Do you see an opportunity there, as Ms. Plettenberg talked about, to potentially work with our teams to have citizens potentially there to be able to watch that, whatever we come out with here, to be able to be on duty to watch sort of 24/7, depending on how the process, is that an important piece of this for you?
Madam Chair, Representative Sprunger, I would say that that is a good component. Just taking part of my clothes, when I was going around talking to other representatives and senators, they all told me stories of citizens that live in their communities that went through the training but have never been called. I know three people off the top of my head that have gone through the training multiple times and have never been called. So the staffing thing, plus I would argue that the elections usually take 1 or 2 months. They've got 8 months out of, or 10 months out of the year to train up the staff they need. It's not like we don't know these elections are coming a year ahead of time. So I think there is the staffing. I think with the renewed interest in our elections that they can get the staffing.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Hellegard.
Thank you.
Representative Sprunger, Representative Hellegard. Representative Walsh.
Madam Chair, question for the bill sponsor.
Representative Walsh, Representative Hellegard.
Madam Chair, Madam Representative Walsh.
Madam Chair, Representative, could you just define, I'm understanding that a lot of the big counties start counting the absentee ballots on Monday, and then prior to the election, and then continue on through the general election on Tuesday, and then provisional ballots on the following Monday. Would you expect that with this language that it would be a continuous process, that there would be no stopping when they started on Monday, whether that was at noon or 5 o'clock or whatever that might be, until the provisional ballots are counted?
Madam Chair, Representative Walsh, I would expect the procedures and the protocols to be exactly the same as they were
before the language was taken out. And they were doing all of that stuff before the language was taken out. So I think that's more of a policy issue than what this bill does. It just says once they start counting on election day is what the protocol was before. They don't stop until they publish the results.
Madam Chair, could I redirect that to Mr. Corson?
Sure. Representative Walsh, Mr. Corson.
Madam Chair, Representative Walsh. So if I have the language of your question right, you know, what is the practice? I think...
Not necessarily what the practice is what's written here. So it just says that once the official count must be open to the public and continue without adjournment until complete. So if we start counting on Monday and we haven't completed it, is that what's the process, I guess?
Madam Chair, Representative Wells, thanks for the clarification. So the practical point of the matter is, you know, you've got the bulk of the absentee that are happening that can be started by more than a few counties on Monday. Certainly everybody on Tuesday can start counting. And then you go to completion for whatever that is. And as Eric spoke about, you've got baskets or bins full of provisional ballots that will have to be done that take time to do. But those are not the substantial portion of the votes. Those have a cure time up until Monday at 3 o'clock. Most counties in the last election started that work in the afternoon on Monday and got it completed. And then you had your unofficial results. With everything being counted. So there would be a big gap of time, you know, sometime after the main counts or main votes are counted on Tuesday and Wednesday to figure out what you're going to do with your 1,000 or 2,000 provisional votes and get them in on Monday by 3 p.m. I think, you know, in terms of my testimony, looking at that, the public interest and the candidate interest, you know, I think it's legislative purview here to clarify that and help the stakeholders, the consumers of the election information through your legislative purview.
Representative Mr. Corson. Representative Yakovich.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I'd like to ask a question to Ms. Plettenberg.
Representative Yakovich. Ms. Plettenberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Plettenberg, thank you for being on. And one issue that continues to reverberate is about trust. And I'm sure we're going to be dealing a lot with this as we move forward. Whether trust has been broken or not, we hear from both sides. So you helped me hit a nail on the head here as we move forward on this bill. Let's say the bill moved forward. I appreciate your attitude that we want to create a surety, ease a sense of people's concern. And so my question is, well, your job would be as the Montana Association clerk and recorders, are you first question, are you in charge of all of them?
Madam Chair, Representative, great question. I am actually the legislative chair, so I do speak on a lot of bills for the association, but we vet them, of course, through the association. I do like to work with sponsors. That's always our first, because there is always a concern behind every bill, and we understand that. And we heard the concerns from the proponents. And instead of just making us kill ourselves and have zombies counting ballots, I would love to work with the committee on maybe an amendment that could address the ability to allow us, especially that Monday before. I think that is so helpful, and, you know, work on, you know, what that security would look like. And if, you know, I think we already have a good process in place through rules, which is in 44.3.2204. But if we need to add additional, I really feel our association, and I'll talk, you know, we'll work through an amendment with the group, but I think we'd be willing to work on that. And, you know, try to put in put things in place that could assure people. I hate to think we've lost everyone's trust. I do think we have a lot of support, even from members of this committee. I know we do, but I, you know, definitely we've always got to work to keep that, and that is our job. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you. Follow up, Madam Chair.
Follow up.
So thank you. I appreciate that attitude and hoping that, you know, there can be a way with this bill. And so I just want to ask you another question, just a follow up. And Representative Hildegard mentioned a point of people going through training. And, you know, wherever you go, there's a work shortage. So I get it. But I think we have to deal with it. So in terms of training people for oversight and training, do you find that people are coming to these trainings and are willing to work in these different counties or not?
Madam Chair, Representative, as I testified, I think in a prior bill that you heard with election judges, I did anyway. In my county, I had a lot of people that signed up. Sounds like the same in many counties that I've talked to of new people. What I didn't get was retention. People that had worked before, that's where I had a shortage. So I am hoping that I get return judges for the next election. That is my hope. That's always the hope, because there's really nothing like experience. And we don't run elections every day, even though I know we have time off, and especially of the magnitude of a general, you know, federal primaries and especially generals. You just don't. And next time will be a presidential. And that is just, honestly, even new clerks that we have that haven't done a presidential yet, we warn them, just wait. That train is coming at you. And so that's the difficulty.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Ms. Plettenberg.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you, Ms. Plettenberg. Representative Running Wolf.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question for Mr. Corson.
Representative Running Wolf, Mr. Corson.
Chair Dooling, Representative Running Wolf.
Good to see you. Thank you.
Good to see you too. Thanks.
Madam Chair, I have a question for him. And it has a lawsuit or judgment been made against this 2019 amendment since it's been in place to your office?
And Madam Chair, Representative Running Wolf, no, that hasn't been one of the legal challenges.
So no legal challenge has been?
Correct.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you, Mr. Corson. Representative Staffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question for Mr. Semerod, please.
Representative Staffman, Mr. Semerod.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Semerod, good morning, and thank you so much for your very detailed testimony. I found it very helpful. My question is that since this bill says once you start the count, you have to continue unabated, and therefore, obviously, you couldn't start on Monday and then break and then resume on Tuesday, so you'd have to wait on Monday for the early votes until Tuesday. And then you'd have to go through this whole process that you described. I'm not going to repeat it, but that it, in fact, creates difficulties with finding enough experienced workers, with fatigue, and it would go on for days and days. And it also would take away from the ability to prepare for the election on the day of the election, because you have to divert workers for that. And all of this that you've described, would it be fair to say that this bill would actually increase the possibility of errors and mistakes and would render our elections less secure, not more?
Madam Chair, Representative Staffman, I mean, you could say that. We're already at our limits, I believe, when we're conducting this election. And to add that without adjournment, and I'm not sure what that would mean, if it meant that we wouldn't be able to start on Monday, or if we did start on Monday, we'd have to continue through the night and on Monday night and into Tuesday and Tuesday night. It could end up being more like 60 hours straight instead of, well, the reason that we go into Wednesday and on to Thursday is because we received so many absentee ballots on election day, and many of those come in very late in the day, and so we don't even have time to process them on election day. And so, would that create more errors? You can say that. I can't predict what it would be, but you definitely could make that statement.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you, Mr. Semerad. Representative Rexton's next.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question for Ms. Plettenberg.
Representative Ms. Plettenberg.
Madam Chair, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Plettenberg, with an amendment that you seem to allude to, is it possible where a schedule for counting could be established that's reasonable, where the public is fully aware when ballots are going to be counted and not counted, and that if they're not being counted, that the security for those ballots would be publicized?
Madam Chair, Representative, that's exactly what I was kind of thinking of, is if maybe we had a set time, set schedule, the public knows about it, even if we have to, you know, notice that, you know, or post it, I'm guessing, you know, and which is kind of what we do for that. That's about that process for the early prep. So I do think we could expand it, tighten it up, and, you know, make sure, you know, whatever needs to be done. I know Ms. Pearson said something, how she posts deputies. She mentioned a log, things like that. And I don't have an amendment written, admittedly, but definitely it'd be something we could definitely work on with the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you, Ms. Plettenberg. Next on the list is Representative Brockman.
Madam Chair, I'd like to ask Jen Hensley a question.
Representative Brockman, Ms. Hensley.
Madam Chair, Representative Brockman.
Hi, Ms. Hensley. A question about worker shortage. Can you tell me how the larger counties, the Missoulas, the Gallatins, the Flatheads, deal with their worker shortages for elections?
Sure, Madam Chair, Representative Brockman, thank you for the question. And I would also, if I'm incomplete in my answer, I'd encourage you to also redirect to some of the election officials online. I can say that, from personal experience, having been a poll worker myself, the counties recruit many nerds like myself who get a charge out of ushering folks from registering to voting for their very first time, regardless of who they cast their ballot for. I think there are a lot of great people in our community who have that Tuesday available to them and the flexibility in their lives to serve in that capacity. Additionally, I truly believe that the 2019 bill allowing for flexibility in counting is addressing the workforce shortage. If you talk to any business owner or industry leader, workforce shortages require creative thinking about how to use that workforce, when to use them. When times are slow, you shift the workload to when that happens, when you've got the folks at your disposal. So I think the workforce shortage is being dealt with by 2019, and it would be exacerbated by reverting back to prior to 19. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you, Ms. Hensley. Representative Baum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I actually have several questions with different persons. My first one I will direct with Lisa Bennett. I believe she was the one from Carbon County.
Representative Baum, Ms. Bennett.
Madam Chair, Representative Baum.
Ma'am, in your testimony, you stated you were from Carbon County.
Correct.
Help me understand, are you part of the election judge
process?
I am
not. I am a citizen and a voter. I'm an elector.
So none of the information
follow
you provided?
Up.
I'm sorry?
Follow-up?
Yes. I'm sorry, Madam Chair, follow-up. So the information you provided wasn't from a direct knowledge or any of your participation in the process? Is that correct?
No, it's not. It is
okay.
From my direct involvement
okay.
in the process.
It's not from your direct involvement? in the process.
If I understand the question correctly, I did review video from the night. I was there in the clerk's office the day of the election. I'm not sure if I'm understanding your question, but I was there. I participated.
Okay, so you were the one of the public viewers? Is that...
So there were other poll watchers there, especially during the evening. I was not there during the evening. I was there first thing in the morning to witness first thing in the morning. And also we, as a central committee in Carbon County, purchased the video footage of the entire 24-hour period. And we reviewed that footage from all the cameras, four internal, one external. And so from participating in the viewing of the entire night, even if I was not present, I witnessed. May I add something, Madam Chair?
Sure.
I also listened to Senate Bill 61 by Senator Ellis yesterday, and Commissioner Jeff Mangdon was specifically asked if there were any credible threats. This was asked by Chairman Cuff to any election administrators or judges, et cetera. And he indicated at that meeting that there were none that were like filed where someone was arrested or anything like that. So I just wanted to reiterate against testimony that was brought here earlier that there's lots of threats that even Mangdon, Commissioner of Political Practice, said that there weren't any. It was just like a consensus feel.
Thank you. Any other questions or any other follow-ups?
Yes, I do. For the bill sponsor, please.
Representative Baum.
Thank you, Representative Hellegard.
Madam Chair, Representative Baum.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. And I think you may have spoke to it a little bit, but can you provide some more insight regarding some of the opponents' presentation regarding the extraordinary length that these workers would be from start to finish, because that seems quite an extraordinary requirement as far as time. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, my thoughts on that are that the electorate's behaviors have not changed dramatically in 2 years. They were able to handle all of this up until the 2020 election. Dana Corson said, they do have additional time to deal with the provisional ballots. And like I said, we've got, well, a matter of fact, I was talking to someone that had gone through the training, had never gotten a call. They were being counseled by someone that did work the election. Oh, you have to call multiple times every day for the 2 weeks before the election before they'll let you work. There's been stories in the Missoulian where people have gone through the training, shown up to work, and been told to go home. So, you know, as I've thought about this, they were able to handle this process up until 2020. So what has drastically changed in 2 years that they can't go back to their old practices and protocols that have the public's trust?
Population growth, for one.
I'm
sorry, ma'am.
Madam Chair, I understand that there has been population growth, but with that population growth, probably statistically would also give you access to more workers for the elections.
Thank you. Vice Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This first question would be for Ms. Pearson.
Vice Chair Phelan, Ms. Pearson.
Okay. Madam Chair. Anyway, Ms. Pearson, I wondered, do you have individual precincts count the votes?
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay.
Did you hear my question?
I did.
We do not have individual precincts count the votes anymore. We used to have polling place tabulators, but due to multiple reasons, one being the concern of machines, we now bring those ballots in at the end of the night and we tabulate those through a central count. So no, the precinct folks, they do have to reconcile against their poll books and bring everything in with a count, but not necessarily a count in the sense of the entire ballot being counted, the races on the ballot being counted. It's just a reconcile with the number of ballots that should be coming in.
Thank you, Madam. Follow-up, please.
Follow-up.
Ms. Pearson, don't you think it would be a lot faster if you counted the ballots at the precinct level rather than trying to bottleneck everything up wherever you count them at?
Chairman, we have done that with the tabulators in the past, and then there were concerns brought forward about the equipment for those very reasons that some of the proponents or opponents are expressing now with their concerns with equipment, which is why we went away from that. And no, I don't agree that it would be faster for it to be counted that night. Most of those election judges have been there since 6 o'clock in the morning or earlier, and they don't close the polls until 8 o'clock at night. So you're asking people that have worked an incredibly hectic day for elections to then have clear mind and ability to process and count all ballots at the end of their shift. I think you're asking a lot.
Follow up. Madam Chair, this would be for Mr. Simrod. Or Simrad.
Thank you, Ms. Pearson. Representative Vice Chair Phelan, Mr. Simrad.
Yes.
Yes. Mr. Simrad, Madam Chair, Mr. Simrad, on the training of election workers or judges, however you, in your testimony, you talked about using your paid employees to count the ballots. And so it seems to me then that you're leaving the public out of the process. Is this correct, Madam Chair?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Phelan. We do not leave the public out of the process. We do have a lot of employees that help with the election. And this is, that those employees are vetted by the county. They've had background checks and things like that, much more so than the election judges that we hire temporarily. And the thing about using county employees for this is continuity. They have memory for having done the process before, whereas when we hire people, temporary workers, often those people have no experience, and we have to train them from the ground up every single election. This election in particular, this past year, we had very few return election judges from previous years. So there were very few skilled election judges that had any experience doing the things that we had to do. And so it was difficult having to kind of go from the ground up with so many folks.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Follow up.
Mr. Simrod, I thought you did election training. And so if you do the election training, surely they are not just going in there cold. Correct?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Phelan. They're not going in cold. They've had training. But the jobs that they do are solidified by repetition, okay? And if they've never ever served as a judge before, kind of the primary, so we trained the judges in April, and the primary election was the kind of the dry run for the general election. It's a much lower turnout, and so they have time to be able to do all these tasks. And then when they're go to the general election, they've got a little bit of experience doing that. But, you know, the people that the days, you know, having come through elections, I've been doing this for 33 years. And over the years, we had election judges that had been there for 30, 40 years. And they had the experience of running those processes. And we just don't have that institutional knowledge in that base anymore. It's different than what it was, you know, 20, 30 years ago, or even 5 or 6 years ago. It's changed. But the people that were working as election judges for so long are not interested in doing the work.
Thank you. Follow up for another person.
Thank you, Mr. Simrod, Vice Chair. Who would you like?
Ms. Bennett. I just was wondering if you would...
Through the chair. Ms. Bennett, please.
Chair, you, Representative Chair. Phelan.
Would you please clarify your security concerns?
Absolutely. So what we were made aware of is that the absentee ballots, which in our county are about 75%, were opened up on Monday. They were kept in a vault. Our clerk's office is a former bank branch office. They were kept in a vault. The following day, based on video footage, and we were told, by the way, through a meeting with our clerk and election administrator, our county has one of each. We're one of 8 counties that does that. We were told that these ballots were kept in secured, sealed envelopes with seals over them. What we see in the video footage, though, are loose ballots all night long coming from the vault, not in sealed envelopes, and not going to the tabulator room. We see those going to what they might call the reconciliation room, which we call the intake or receiving room for, like, where ballot boxes would come in from a police officer or deputy bringing them in. We see a lot of security concerns in these videos, and I'm more than happy to share this video with everyone here on this committee. We see the possibility, or not just the possibility, we actually see in the video the clerks handling the ballots, not election judges. We do not see election judges in the vault. The only ones entering are staff from the clerk's office, including the clerk who's on the ballot and the election administrator. We had very grave concerns with this, especially when we see a stack of absentee ballots going to the clerk's desk, which is not the receiving room or the reconciliation room. It's not the tabulator room, is not the resolution room, and being sorted at her desk. We see a lot of things that we're concerned with in this video. And for that reason, and the fact that the clerks tell us, and we see on video from the outside camera, commissioners who are not on duty, who are not poll watchers, who are not election judges, in and out of this facility where all these ballots are, the clerk's office, coming and going with their own keys. Same thing with the clerk staff coming and going with their own keys at all hours with nobody there to have any oversight. When the clerk is on the ballot, and our clerk won by approximately 80 votes, I will share with this committee that there are other disconcerting things that we see on this video. The poll watcher who was there all night, full disclosure, was my husband, and he was threatened over and over again. He, the poll watcher, that if he left the tabulator room where he was sequestered, he was not allowed to freely go and ask questions or walk around, as the poll watcher statutes say that, or the rules say that he can. He was threatened by the police officer that if he didn't sit down and stay in his seat in that tabulator room and stop asking any questions, he would be escorted out of the building. So my husband, out of fear that he would miss something, obeyed, because he knew that he would be thrown out. So his rights as a citizen to watch the procedures and to ask questions about the procedures were completely violated. He went along with it because he felt it was still more important for him to see whatever he could see. So he stayed to see what he could. He was hoping that the video cameras would be able to give him more information. Unfortunately, the black screen restricted a lot of what we could see, but we did see some things. So our concern is that we had plenty of election judges. We didn't have a single Republican judge in there because our Republican Central Committee did not send their list on time of judges.
and our election administrator did not want to have a 50-50. She claims, I don't know who anyone is as far as a partisan. And so my husband was the only one there that was a Republican for the entire night. And he was definitely not treated well, and we definitely had concerns
Madam Chair,
that citizens didn't have oversight.
Representative Staffman.
This is getting off the bill, and I'm concerned about that.
It's not, because it has to do with, if you count straight
through the chair, please.
Chair Dooling, it does not, because the whole point of not stopping the vote is to make sure that we always have the ability to have citizens there to oversee what our clerk staff is doing. Now, it's very possible that there could be logical reasons for why they did what they did. Maybe they didn't know they were doing something that they shouldn't have been doing. But without a citizen there to oversee what's happening, then there's no one to report what's happening. And the fact that these people can get into the office at any time of the day or night in between leaves the process open for lack of transparency and security, and I think that's what we're trying to close up. And I'm fine if we have to amend things, but somehow we need to make sure that there is citizen oversight, not police officer oversight, not clerk oversight, but citizens, because we're the only ones that check government in this procedure.
Thank you, Mrs.
Thank
Bennett.
You.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Representative Bertolio.
Madam Chair, question for Ms. Bennett.
Representative Bertolio, Mrs. Bennett.
Madam Chair,
Representative Bertolio, thank you.
Thank you for being here today. A quick question just on that last one. Have you actually watched, do you have a problem with the fact that the clerk took the envelope to the desk, or that the envelope was taken to the desk? Have you seen when they actually reconciled the signatures on the absentee ballots? Have you seen that process?
Representative Bertolio, so our video does not encompass that Monday night when those signatures were verified and the ballots were open. It simply is the ballots themselves that are being carried. So they're opened already. They're tri-folded like they would be from the envelope and brought over to the desk. Our concern is that our clerk who handled those ballots and her staff who sorted those ballots at her desk, she was on that ballot and she won by only about 80 votes. And why are ballots being sorted or clerk only, no judges here, handling these ballots? The protocol and chain of custody, which we have on video of our clerk and our election administrator stating, is that they don't handle the ballots, that they are only dealt with in the reconciliation room, which is like the intake receiving room, and they go straight from there either to the resolution board room if there's an issue with the ballot that they have to fix, or straight into the tabulator room. But that's not what we're seeing on the video. Thank you, Madam
Chair.
Thank
you.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you, Mrs. Bennett. Representative Staffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question for Mr. Corson, please.
Representative Staffman, Mr. Corson.
Madam Chair and Representative Staffman.
Mr. Corson, Madam Chair, thank you. Mr. Corson, I know you were here yesterday and last week for the bills that Representative Beatty proposed, and he made some comments which I think are apropos to this bill as well. And I'm trying to understand the Secretary of State's position on all this, and I want to know I've tried to jot down the comments and want to know if you still agree with Representative Beatty's comments, specifically that Montana's election system has proven to be fair, well-run, and secure year after year, that skilled and competent local officials run our elections and ensure that every eligible Montana can fulfill their right to vote, and that there have been no problems with the fairness or security of elections in Montana. And finally, he said that baseless accusations of fraud or abuse in our system are dangerous, unfounded, and actually restrict Montana's ability to vote. Do you agree with those sentiments that he expressed?
Madam Chair and Representative Staffman, so yes, we agree with that. And as a reminder, the Manco Committee conducted their own study as well and came out with similar conclusions.
Great. Thank you so much. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Corson. Thank you, Representative Staffman. Any other questions from the committee? Representative Green.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is for Mr. Corson.
Representative Green, Mr. Corson.
Madam Chair and Representative Green.
Madam Chair, Mr. Corson, thank you for being here. Once again, I'm sorry I came from another meeting, and maybe this has already been clarified, but the accusations that I'm hearing that came from Carbon County sounds like those may have been violations that should have went to the Office of Political Practices. Would that be correct?
Madam Chair and Representative Green, Commissioner of Political Practices doesn't always catch reports of violation, but certainly, if there was an infraction of law, it should have been reported to, local law enforcement, county attorney, Commissioner of Political Practices for enforcement. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. Follow-up?
Follow-up.
Madam Chair, Mr. Corson, so if there were violations in the election process that needed to go to the Office of Political Practice, wouldn't there still be the problem if this wasn't followed and it wasn't reported? Wouldn't enforcement of no matter what the election laws are, this if we don't enforce them, then it's kind of moot anyway?
And Madam Chair and Representative Green, so a couple different paths for reports like this. So perhaps it was reported. Let's assume that for an instance. And for what was presented, didn't merit, or maybe it merited an investigation, maybe it didn't. If it did, there was nothing conclusionatory on it and no further action required by the agency. Those are possible outcomes. So,
thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Baum.
Madam Chair, this would be for the bill sponsor, please.
Representative Baum, Representative Hellegard.
Madam Chair, Representative Baum.
Madam Chair, Representative. So in your comments from other committee questions, it seems like that you're just trying to get more transparency and more citizen oversight. Is that what I'm understanding as far as the construction of this bill?
Representative Baum, Madam Chair, I think we are trying to get transparency, and I think what I've heard from people is when they stop and start the counts, those sometimes are random, so that the citizens don't know that they have stopped the count or when they're starting again. So by just continuing it, it makes it easier for the public and the electorate to oversee the elections that they're participating in.
Follow-up, Madam Chair?
Follow-up.
So it would seem to me that if you want more participation, citizen oversight, I don't foresee a large part of the population that in the wee morning hours that would be able to participate for various reasons in that oversight. And I'm just wondering if you're amenable to a suggestion from another committee member as far as specific scheduled process, then that would allow awareness to the public as to when these counts would be taking place. And I think that would provide a lot more transparency.
Madam Chair, Representative Baum, that would provide, let's say, a measure, but not the full extent. We also heard, and we've seen national videos, where the election workers dismiss all of the public saying we're closing down, but yet the county workers continue to work, continue to run ballots, continue to pull ballots out from underneath tables where the public does not have access to that. So just by posting times that they're going to be counting and stuff, I don't think that would get the public where they need to be. It would have to be that all of the workers would have to be dismissed, the doors locked so nobody can get in. They all show up at the same time. They're all let in at the same time. So it would be having to collect all the keys that the county workers have so that one person has a key. And then the onus would fall on them to make sure that everyone left the building.
Thank you. And one additional follow-up, please,
Madam Chair. Follow-up.
So I understand that. But again, having that transparency. So those are, as far as you're saying, county workers continuing to count or what have you, those are all internal policies, et cetera, which could be adjusted. So in the purposes of transparency, to try to achieve what you're looking, as far as, you know, what are we looking at, locking the door, housing these individuals, you know, for 40-plus hours, not allowing them. Well, when you say continuous, I mean, that's what you're saying. So what I'm trying to disascertain kind of a where we might go with this. So if that internal process for each individual county, as is security in those individual counties, that's their responsibility, does that sound like that would achieve the purpose and intent?
Madam Chair, Representative Baum, by doing it with policy, with no enforcement mechanism there, I don't see that getting us there. I've been working or researching elections since 2012. The public's trust in our elections have only continued to degrade since that time. And I think when you look at the number of election bills that have been running through these committees year after year, session after session, the people feel they need to come to their representatives and their senators to give them redress on this issue. So by letting the counties come up with policies that there's no enforcement mechanism, I don't think that's going to rebuild the trust of our citizens.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you, Representative Hellegard. Vice Chair Phelan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Being that Representative Green brought up the COPP issue for Carbon County, I would like to direct that question to Ms. Bennett to see what her, if that occurred.
Madam Chair,
Representative Phelan, Mrs. Bennett.
Madam Chair, Representative Phelan. So the poll watcher report that my husband filled out went to everyone. It went to COPP, it went to Austin Knutson, it went to the Secretary of State. We sent it everywhere. The responses we got from everyone was elections are local. We have no jurisdiction. We do not represent you. We're poll watchers. Go get an attorney. Go to court. That's what we're told. So as a citizen, our only recourse when we see something going wrong is to actually have to pay an attorney to fight county attorneys who are representing the county employees to seek redress for something that is wrong. That morning that I was there at 7:30, I took my phone out and I was going to send a text to let them know that they weren't tabulating yet, to let my husband and other poll watchers that were interested in coming. At that point, I was threatened that I would be escorted out of the building. The police officer on duty stood up and went right into my face to say, if you don't put that phone away, you're out of here. And I said, what's wrong? You can't have a phone. But all night long, the commissioners are on their phone, the clerks are on their phone, the police officer is on his phone on that video. Now, according to, I believe it's statute MCA 48-8-201, it says that we are allowed to video record any elected official in the course of them doing business. Therefore, I have the right to have my phone out. As long as I'm not taking a picture of someone voting, I have the right to take a picture of them doing their job. But the only thing that I could do was go to court and get an injunction. So I thought, what the heck? Should I do that? Well, then I find out it's a state holiday and all courts are closed. So as a citizen, I don't have the courts to go to. I did call the Montana GOP and I did report this to the Montana GOP, and I didn't get anything from them either. So to answer your question, Green, it was reported, and what we got was go get an attorney, and good luck. And with the limited amount of time you have on election day to get anything enforced, and with courts closed, essentially citizens have been deprived of their right of due process. So the police officer on duty acts more like a bouncer to enforce the interpretations of the law based on the election administrator and county clerk. I did at one point have the law in my hand to show them for them to read, and they glanced at it cursorily and basically said, the clerks need to interpret this. It's not our job.
Thank you,
Ms. Police
Bennett.
Officers don't know
Thank
the law.
Thank you, Mrs. Bennett.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Ms. Bennett.
Representative Walsh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A question for Dana Corson, please.
Representative Walsh, Mr. Corson.
Madam Chair and Representative Walsh.
Just to get back to the bill itself, because that's where we're here to hear testimony on. So looking at the language, and please interpret this as you would see it. So when would the election start, reading lines 10 and 11 and 12, any official vote count must be open to public authorization and continue. So when does the election start, voting start, and when does it end?
So, Madam Chair and Representative Wolf, so you're talking about voting, so maybe are you talking about counting
of
the votes?
I'm reading the statute, official vote count.
Okay.
So when does official vote count start?
So that can start as early as the day before. It's county choice. Certainly it'll start on election day.
When does it end?
Follow up.
So, Madam Chair and Representative Wall, so typically in the 2019 and pre-era, you know, that would end when ballots that can be counted are counted. If you have provisionals and things like that, those are wrestled out during the following days, must be concluded by the following Monday by 3 p.m.
Madam Chair, just a follow-up.
Follow-up.
So we can change this. What I'm trying to get to is, we have official vote count, and when we start on, whether that is Monday or Tuesday morning or whenever that is the count done at when just the regular ballots are done, the overcounts are tabulated, the provisional ballots, aren't we still counting votes?
Madam Chair and Representative Walsh, so you're counting votes until Monday at 3 o'clock. So if you have a bunch of provisionals that you start working on from Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and into Monday, but substantially speaking, you know, the absentee and the polling place people, those are going to be done as quickly as possible after the close of polls on Tuesday. And, of course, you know, none of those counts are official until they become canvassed.
I don't want to belabor the issue, but because we have it in here, continue without adjournment. So what I'm just trying to say, what's going to be, we don't adjourn until we get the provisionals and everything done, or we talk about substantial. That I don't see the word substantial in here any place.
And Madam Chair and Representative Wall, so that might have been a poor choice of words on my part, but from the public aspect of it, substantially counted is everything that can be counted at the time that isn't provisional. And of course, clerks and election offices are going to be working on provisionals starting the day after the election up to Monday at 3 p.m. So working on those provisionals, maybe you're checking ID, maybe you're checking the lack of a signature, maybe signatures don't match, whatever the case may be for provisional resolution, those are the types of activities that are done with the expectation that they're done by 3 p.m. the following Monday.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you, Mr. Corson. Any Representative Perry?
Madam Chair, this question would be for Mr. Corson.
Representative Perry, Mr. Corson.
So given the language that we were just, Madam Chair, Mr. Corson, given the language that we were just talking about, how do you see that actually working? I mean, logistically, how does that work and satisfy the intent of the bill?
And Madam Chair and Representative Perry, so, you know, the intent of the bill, in its plain read, the underlying section that you have, like on line 14 there, you know, that is the re-enabling of the exact language as it was in 2019 prior to the session. So we're going back to the same standards that we had and the same processes that we had in 2019. The practical point of all this is, you know, from the public interest standpoint, from the press, the candidates, of course, you know, everybody wants to get as much information as possible, as quickly as possible. So we do what we can to make sure that those votes are counted accurately, quickly, and up to the point we can, where if you have to do some resolution or do some provisional work, you've got those numbers in hand as quickly as possible, knowing that everything will be done by Monday, 3 p.m.
Follow up. Madam Chair, Mr. Corson, with this language that says continue without adjournment, though, how can we actually practically do that, knowing that we still have provisionals that have to be reconciled?
And Madam Chair and Representative Perry, so that's part of law that legislators put into place to allow for that. Part of the time period for, you know, the Tuesday to the following Monday are UACABA voters, too, or uniformed and overseas voters, to allow for ballots to be in the hands of the clerk's office. So there's some federal timing that goes into that because that's part of a federal act. So that time period we're talking about, there's still some activity. It is the minority of the activity for everybody, but it's still work that needs to be done. In terms of vote counting, if you've got a provisional that's waiting on something or a UCAVA vote to arrive, if it isn't in your hands or it isn't resolved, you really can't do anything to do the count. And what happens is on the following Monday, clerks will get together, have that done by 3 o'clock, and then they update the results and it's ready for post-election audit and canvas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Corson.
Thank you, Mr. Corsman. Representative Perry, Representative Staffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a question to follow up on Representative Perry and Representative Walsh for Mr. Corson, if I might.
Mr. Corson.
Mr. Corson, sorry. So we've been talking about the exact wording of this proposed bill, and we've mostly been talking about adjournment until it's completed. And it, as I understand it, it's not completed until all these other processes are done, which is going to be the following Monday. And the result must be then publicly declared. So right now we don't have a result until that following Monday. So then am I correct that the effect of this bill would require that the work that has now been done being done from the course of 8 days or so into a period that's got to be continuous until it's done with no stops? And is that, am I understanding that correctly?
Chair Dooling and Representative Staffman. So I think it's just the curious wording and the interplay of activities. So, you know, the official vote count, you know, if we've got everything counted and we're trying to resolve other stuff, you can't count votes until they're ready. So the deadline on that is just simply by 3 o'clock the following Monday. So if you got something to, knowing that you've got something to count that can't be counted, the counting doesn't happen until it can be resolved. So you've got the resolution board, you've got UACAPA stuff coming in, all these factors coming in, but we know we've got an impending deadline of Monday, 3 o'clock following the election. So there's been a natural stop over the years just for that, and it's provided for in law.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Corson. Representative Staffman, any other questions from the committee? Seeing none, Representative Hellegard, would you like to close on your bill?
Madam Chair, I do appreciate all of you taking such enormous time to discuss this bill, so I'll keep my close short. All we're asking is that we go back to the protocols that were in place in 2019. And since this language was removed, the voters having the integrity and security of our elections has eroded. I ask a due pass in an effort to start restoring voter trust. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative. And this closes the hearing on House Bill 196. I would like to thank Mrs. Chvilacek, Mrs. Hale, and Mrs. Bennett for coming in. Citizen participation is very important in this process. Thank you so much.
Madam Chair, a point of privilege.
Representative Baum.
I would ask that the information that was passed out as a matter of record not be attached to the bill, since the individual is not allowed to verbally present it because it did not pertain to the bill. She's welcome, obviously, to pass it out, but just that it's not attached as information for record. Is that?
Let me find out how that works, and I'll get back to you, okay?
Okay.
Thank you. Can we take... Vice Chair Phelan needs a break. Let's take a five-minute break, and then we will start with Representative Mercer's bill. Thank you. Committee members, let's get back to order, please.
Michael,
oh, sir,
how are you?
Doing good.
Thank you for your
yeah.
So these are a couple of handouts I'd like to make part of the record.
Okay.
I hope I have enough copies. I think I'm right around 19.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Representative Mercer.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Can I step out at 11 to a meeting?
Yes.
Meeting?
Yes. All right. Well, we will now hear House Bill 190, sponsored by Representative Mercer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Bill Mercer. I represent House District 46 in the Magic City, and happy to be back in front of this committee. And, you know, I always hate to rate bills in terms of importance, in terms of which ones I'm really most enthusiastic about, because next time I'm here, you're going to say, I thought you said that other one was the most important one. This, to me, when people say to me, why do you run for the legislature? Why do you do that? I say, I do it because I want to improve the overall effectiveness of state government. And that includes both the legislature and the executive. And so this bill has become sort of a passion for me because of what I've experienced in the first two terms. When I was here in 2019, I've been on the Appropriations Committee. I've never been on a policy committee, but I've been on the Appropriations Committee since I got here. And I was on Section A, and that's the one that deals with general government as a freshman. And one by one, as agencies came in to present their budget, I said, can I get a copy of your strategic plan? And I would usually get a very blank stare. And I'd usually get an answer like, well, we have a mission statement. Or we might have a goal or an objective statement. And so I'd say, well, do you have performance measures? Do you have anything that would allow us to know what it is that you want to achieve and how you want to measure that? And I did not get that from a single entity in Section A as a freshman. And I really came to find out that it wasn't limited to Section A agencies. Section B, Section C, I'll get back to B. Section C, Section D, and Section E, they didn't have any sort of strategic plan either. So why is this of interest to me? And I'm going to violate the rule that my mother taught me, which is not to talk about myself, because I think you have to hear that in order to understand why I think this is among the most important things that you're going to hear from me about. So I was an executive branch guy for 21 years. I'm not anti-executive branch. Now, admittedly, it was in the federal side, but I understand that the executive branch has the responsibility to implement what we do, to carry out the statutes that are enacted, to take the money that we have and to faithfully implement it. I understand that's their responsibility. On the other hand, our responsibility isn't just limited to setting a budget and passing statutes. We've got to have optics into what is being done. What is it that we thought we were going to achieve when we said, yeah, we'll fund that position. Yes, we will sponsor that piece of legislation. So I was in the U.S. Attorney's Office in Montana from 1994 to 2009. And before that, I was at the Department of Justice in D.C. And then I went back to the Department of Justice for a year where I oversaw all the grant making that's done by the Department of Justice, and I oversaw all the litigating divisions in the Department of Justice. When I left the government, I served on four nonprofit boards. And one of the things I want to say here at the outset is that when we've debated this in the past, it's very, very bipartisan. Former Senator Bennett from Missoula, who carried this for me over in the Senate last time, has had a lot of nonprofit experience, and he said, I'm just sort of gobsmacked that a nonprofit with maybe a budget of $500,000 has a strategic plan, but state agencies don't. And I think that that's certainly where I'm coming from. When I was the U.S. attorney, I wanted to identify how it was that we could answer this one question. How do we know whether we have been successful or not? All of you that have spent time in the private sector, you, I think, intuitively know this is such an easy question in the private sector. Companies have shareholders. Shareholders have expectations. They make investments. And they know at the end of the day whether the company is doing what the company should do. Are they maximizing shareholder value? In small businesses, you don't have shareholders necessarily, but you know what it is that you want to generate. Profit is a very easy principle in order to say in the private sector whether you've been successful or not. We don't have that in the public sector. We don't have that in the nonprofit sector. And that's why if you have agencies that aren't sitting back and saying at the beginning of whatever period it is, how will we know whether we have been successful, whether it's at the end of the day, at the end of the fiscal year, or in the case of my time as U.S. attorney, at the end of my term, if I haven't established how I'm going to know whether I was successful or not, it's just unguided, which I don't think is any way to run any sort of an organization. So I want to use this as an example because this is the one from my experience that I hope will give you a metric on the sort of thing that can be done by government. So if a person serves in the U.S. attorney's role in Montana, they have primary responsibility to bring felony charges in Indian country, with the exception of on the Confederates, on the Flathead Reservation, because the Flathead has subjected itself to state regulation. But everywhere else, the U.S. attorney has obligations to bring all the felony cases. Why does that matter to this discussion? Well, because when I looked at how many burglary cases that we were bringing at Fort Peck and on Rocky Boy and on Blackfeet and a Crow and in Northern Cheyenne, it was a very small number. And I thought, that seems bad to me. I don't know if there's something not happening here. Either those cases aren't being investigated or they aren't being referred to us or we're not prosecuting them. And I better figure that out. But I better first figure out how many cases is the county attorney in Phillips County that is adjacent to the Fort Belknap Reservation. I wonder how many burglary cases they're bringing. So we went out and evaluated how many burglary cases were being done in adjacent counties where the state has jurisdiction for those cases off the reservation. And then we tried to look at what do crime reports say the incidence of burglary is. And we found out that we were way below what we should have been doing for burglary cases in Indian Country. And that became one of the things in our strategic plan. Not that we could just automatically drive that number up. That was dependent upon having enough investigative capacity and actually taking those cases seriously. But we had to figure out what it was in the pipeline that was affecting the flow of those cases. And we identified goals to do that, we identified performance measures to do that, and then we tracked that for the remainder of my time as U.S. attorney. So that's, I think some people will say this is very hard to do. Well, if it's hard to do, that doesn't mean that it's not worth doing. And if you don't have for every one of your programs as the director of an agency, if you don't know what it is that you want to achieve so you can say we have succeeded, we said that we were going to do X and we've measured that, and in fact we have done it, or we haven't done it. But if you aren't doing that, I think it's very hard to argue that you have a coherent program. So another thing that I wanted to say about this is that sometimes people think of this sort of in what I will describe as in a vacuum. They say, you know, we're doing X now. What I want to encourage you to think about is this is an attempt to transform the way state government works over time. We should try really hard not to personalize this to a particular governor or to a particular legislature. We should try to imagine, in fact, if you want to imagine that instead you're in Wyoming, if that makes it easier for you than to think about who the governor is or was or who the legislature, who is serving now or will be or was, the point is that you should have an objective approach to say, this isn't about today, This isn't about yesterday. We need to learn from both of those. But this is to try to put us on a trajectory so long after none of us are serving here, long after the current governor is done serving and the people in his cabinet are done serving, what is it that we can have done to transform the way the place works? What can you do to have enduring change? This is not about now. This is about now, the past, and the future, and where we want to end up in the future. I want to talk a little bit about history, because this part of the history is important. I've alluded to this already. There was a bill in the last session that was very close to the bill that's in front of you. It was House Bill 277. And just to give you an idea about the support it had, it passed in the House on third reading 73-25. It passed in the Senate on third reading 49-0. And then when the governor vetoed the bill, it received 105 votes in favor of overriding the veto and 19 against. The only change in this bill is based upon one of the things that was in the veto letter. One of the things in the veto letter said that a problem with the bill is it would require state agencies to allow comments from employees about the strategic plan. Now, I want to tell you, I know there's at least one state employee that's around the table. The reason why that was in the old bill was I think sometimes the best ideas come from the bottom up. And I wanted to ensure that if the best idea in an agency was in the head of a 27-year-old that had no responsibilities of management or leadership, I wanted to make sure that that worked its way into the process. And keep in mind, the legislature doesn't write the strategic plan. The judiciary doesn't write the strategic plan. It's up to the executive branch. But I thought it was a good idea to say, I think we should make sure that all employees get to weigh in, so we make sure that if there are good ideas out there that we're hearing them. But that was one of the things that was said was problematic when the bill got vetoed. I couldn't affect that part of it after the veto, but I thought, well, for now I'm going to take that out. And I'm going to take it out because I'm trying to figure out a way that we can have a marriage here. I'd like to try to get something done that will be transformative. And if this is going to be a hill that this bill is going to die on, I thought I will take it out. Otherwise, the bill is about the same. One thing that didn't change in the bill is there is a public comment component to the bill. And you might say, well, why would you have a public comment on the bill? Well, it's frankly the same reason why I thought it was a good idea to have employees be able to weigh in. It may be that a member of the public, having looked at a department strategic plan, would say, I think that they could do X and they could measure it this way, and that's something that would advance the optimal performance of an agency. And I have been unwilling to take that out because one of the things that animates the executive branch and the legislative branch in the state of Montana is we have a constitutional provision that is allows public participation. And I think that this is enough of an important process that we, after an executive branch agency says, here is our strategic plan, here are our performance measures, I think it's a good idea to put it out there and let the public comment. And again, keep in mind, anyone who says to you this is going to result in the legislature writing the strategic plan or the judiciary writing the strategic plan, it's not right. The responsibility is with the executive, and in fact, the bill specifically exempts any sort of challenge, judicial challenge, based upon public comment. So in other words, this bill says if someone makes a public comment and the executive agency doesn't incorporate something about that comment, there can't be a lawsuit over that. So at the end of the day, this is the strategic plan that the administration, they have final control in terms of what is in the document. But obviously, the benefit to the public policy process is we know where they're going, we know how they're trying to implement things, we know how they want to try to measure things. Talk more about what was in the veto letter, because whether you hear about it now or not, it's important that we hit these topics. One of the reasons why it was vetoed is it resulted in, quote, a rigid 3-year plan that does not provide for nimble adjustments. I disagree with that. A strategic plan can be revised under this bill, as can performance measures be revised before a new plan needs to be done. Would impose these two next two, I want you to consider these together, so I'll read them together. Would impose another bureaucratic process on state agencies that would create more administrative work. So, whole lot of new work. The next one was, quote, in part duplicates processes that I'm already implementing. So you can't have it both ways. Either you're already doing it or you're not. If you're already doing it, this isn't going to create a whole bunch more bureaucratic work. And so the whole point here is that the strategic plan that is laid out, the process that's laid out here, is not being done. But if you have the fiscal note, I'm going to tell you it's not going to cost $1.2 million to do it in a particular fiscal year. The last couple I've already talked about, quote, would require state agencies to go through both an employee comment process and a formal comment, public comment process to produce three-year formal strategic plans, performance measures, and performance reports. And that's half right, given the existing bill. It would still require that. But again, and this could be a potential amendment if somebody on the committee said, I want to exempt the first strategic plan from public comment given the time frame. Because as you can see from the time frame, there would be a statutory requirement that the plan be in place by September 1 of 2023. If you believe that we should not have a public comment process given that time frame, we could defer that until the next cycle. And that I would view that as a friendly amendment. The next comment was 3 years is neither tied to the two-year legislative session cycle nor the gubernatorial election cycle. And again, hold in suspension for a minute the fact that this is about a particular administration or a particular legislature. This is about trying to have an agency plan that says, here's where we're going to go, here's what we want to achieve, here's how we're going to measure it, here's how we're going to know whether we've been successful or not. It doesn't need to be married with a legislative calendar, and it doesn't need to be married with a gubernatorial calendar. As I said already, if a new governor wants to come in at some point and say, we're going to tweak a strategic plan, there's nothing in here that says that that is prohibited. Finally, there was a comment that the Red Tape Relief Advisory Council is conducting, quote, a comprehensive top-to-bottom review of regulations in every state agency. And I really viewed that as a red herring. I'm not talking about regulations. I'm talking about standards, performance measurements. I'm not talking about, I mean, if somebody wanted to say we wanted to reduce regulations in a particular area, that could be something that you could put on a strategic plan. But the Red Tape Reduction Initiative wasn't designed to say, what is the plan for a particular agency? How is it going to be executed? How is it going to be measured? So those were the arguments on why the bill was not good legislation. And I'm happy to take questions from you on any of them. The bill had, as I said, tremendous support because of its content, and I don't think any of those reasons are reasons not to go down this road again. Where do we stand in comparison to other states? I didn't get a copy of this. I didn't remember this early enough, Madam Chair, but there is an article called Performance Budgeting in the American States, What's Law Got to Do with It? Published in 2011. There's a great table here. Table 3, GPP Budgeting for Performance Rating by Performance Budgeting Law Index. There's a yellow line at the bottom of that page. Guess what state that is? Montana. We're literally at the bottom of this page. And as you know, I'd encourage you to think about that as a serious problem as well. Now, there are a couple other things that are in front of you that I wanted to draw your attention to that I think are important fact issues here. I said that 2019 was informative. We got here in 2021. We put the strategic planning bill together. The director of the Legislative Fiscal Division said to me, you know, in your bill, you could strike existing code sections in 17.7.111. Because agencies are required to do what you see in paragraph 2 there as part of what they submit to the budget director, which comes to the Legislative Fiscal Division on September 1 before any legislative session. So, quote, among other things, the submission must contain a statement of the agency mission and a statement of goals and objectives for each program of the agency, and two, sufficient specific information and quantifiable information to enable the legislature to formulate an appropriations policy regarding the agency and its programs, and to allow a determination at some future date on whether the agency has succeeded in attaining its goals and objectives. So I thought, yeah, that makes the strategic planning bill would be more expansive than that. We can strike through that code. Well, as we were getting ready for the debate on this bill, I thought, well, I guess we should find out what was submitted, because certainly thematically that would cover some of the same things in the bill. So as you can see, I sent a letter to the budget director and said, hey, I've looked for this information. I can't find anything from any agency that was submitted with the budget. And it looks like Director Livers had flagged this in the spring when he sent the memo to everybody. And so one by one, people came into the Appropriations Committee, and I had sent them their own letters. And I said, I just wonder if you submitted anything to comply with that statute. One by one, they said no. Which, you know, they'd all been in their jobs for about 2 months. So none of this had been done on their watch, and I got that. But then the follow-up question for career civil servants in the agency was, has it ever been done? Was it done the last time? Was it done in 2018? Because I don't remember any of these documents then either. Well, we don't have any recollection of it ever being done. That is sort of a shame on us moment, right? We pass a statute, we have a purpose for it, and then we don't bother to actually require it. That's a shame on us deal. But it's a shame on the executive branch also, because they've got a different responsibility than we do. They have to implement the law. It's not permissive, right? Didn't see anything in that statute that said, if you want to do it, do it. It said, submit this when you submit your budget request. So when I say try to suspend in your own mind, whether we're talking about this administration or the next administration, this is saying that we put this in the code, and I forget how long it had been there, but it wasn't new. It had been there for a while. And yet, the executive branch just had decided they weren't going to comply with it. And that's, I think, another reason why it's important to have this legislation, so the legislature can understand. We will have a process. We will enforce the process. And we will end up with more optimal outcomes. The second letter that is in front of you is a letter that I sent to the director, DPHHS. And if you get your bill out, go to the end of your bill, you're going to see that this time I'm recommending that we repeal sections. It's new section 11. It's the repealer. Page 11, lines beginning at line 25. So we would repeal a bunch of Title II provisions. What are those provisions? Those are provisions that were established in 2003. And they pertain only to DPHHS. And I'm not going to bother to read those provisions to you, but I'm going to represent to you that it established a statutory requirement that the agency create a strategic plan, that it include performance measures, and that each measure must be central to the success of the process being measured. It defines in 215.22.11, outcome measure as a quantifiable indicator of the public and customer benefits derived from actions by the department and its agencies. Output measures, quantifiable indicator of the number of goods or services that the department of an agency produces. And performance measures, meaning monitoring tools included in the department's or an agency's strategic plan that are intended to help guide government and make it accountable. 20 years ago. So I thought, I want to find out what DPHHS has done with that. So you can see the questions are all on the second page of the letter. OK? Can you tell me what outcome measures have been established over the last 20 years? Same question for output measures, strategic plans, and performance measures. DPHHS did develop a strategic plan in 2019. So when I said earlier, that was the one agency that had a strategic plan when we got here for the 2019 session. But none of those other things have ever been done. So again, this isn't about the present. It's about the past, the present, and the future. And how do we end up with a system where we actually are being guided by these sort of clear metrics on where we need to go? So I haven't spent a whole lot of time talking about the bill, and I do want to quickly do that. You'll see in there's a declaration of the policy and purpose. I think in broad strokes, it just basically says every agency should have a strategic plan. That strategic plan should have performance measures, must have performance measures. That plan with performance measures needs to have outcomes and outputs that, quote, merited the use of taxpayer money. New Section 3 gives you a bunch of definitions. They probably will sound really familiar to you because they are in large part drawn from that statute that I just talked about in Title II that we would be repealing that only pertains to DPHHS. The strategic planning requirement requires in new Section 4, bottom page 2, that no later than the 1st of September of 2023 that each agency would develop a strategic plan. They would do so again at the beginning of fiscal year 26, and that it would be revised no later than every 3 years afterward. Explains what needs to be in the strategic plan. It then describes what a performance measure must do. The public comment piece is on page 3, beginning at subsection 6. There are various things there, including holding one public meeting, accepting public comment for 30 days, posting the notice, all basic MAPA, which is the Montana Administrative Procedure Act, all basic MAPA rulemaking components. Strategic plan would need to be posted on both the website of the department and the website of the Office of Budget and Program Planning. There'd need to be a performance report done annually, no later than December 1st, and obviously the importance of that, particularly preceding a legislative session year, is that we would understand what had been achieved pursuant to the strategic plan. Periodic assessment and audit and revision of those measures. Judicial review, as I said earlier, is exempted. Section 8 says they've got to do this with existing resources. I'll just quickly note that the fiscal note has grown markedly from the last session. And you may already have heard the term death by fiscal note, and that's what's going on here. You hang a big number on here to make it seem like it's going to be really costly to do. And I just ask you to really assess what's changed in 2 years in terms of why the cost would be so much higher. Let's see, Section 10. I know that's a lot of, I actually skipped too far ahead. Let's go to Section 9, which begins on page 5. That is all existing statutory language. The only thing that changed is on page 7, strategic planning documents. And if you say, well, why did we have to do that? We're excluding that from the definition of a rulemaking, which is also tied to the fact that we're precluding any judicial review of what the executive branch agency ultimately promulgates in the way of a strategic plan. Page 7 begins Section 10. Once again, that's all existing language. We have slipped in a carve-out that essentially says, hey, if you've done a strategic plan pursuant to this legislation, you don't need to do anything to comply with the language that was in the letter to Director Almy. So in other words, if we've got a strategic planning process going on, we do not need to duplicate it by asking them to do something as part of what is in Title 17. And you might say, well, wouldn't that cover every agency? Why would we have someone covered by 17 that isn't covered by this? I know for one, the judicial branch is not covered by the strategic planning bill. but the judicial branch is required to submit something to OBPP. So anyone else, which will include, I think, virtually all executive branch agencies, would be exempted if this bill passes from complying with Title 17. I've talked about the repealer in Section 11, and everything else is fairly straightforward. The effective date would be immediate. So I think I've probably given you more than more than you wanted to hear, but I appreciate your attention, and I will be delighted to answer any questions you might have. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Mercer. Are there any proponents in the room? Any proponents for the bill? Any proponents online?
No, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any opponents in the room? Director.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Misty Ann Giles, G-I-L-E-S for the record, and I'm Director of Administration. And I come before you today in opposition of House Bill 190. House Bill 190 states at the onset that its policy and purpose is to optimize the performance of state government, yet the approach and the requirements do just the opposite. By adopting an old-world solution abandoned by both the public and the private sector, and it will instead impede our progress, cost taxpayer dollars, and create reports that don't resolve any actual problem or answer any question that I know you care about, Representative Mercer cares about, and I care about, which is how are we actually doing? One of my favorite quotes describing strategic plans and the approach set forth in House Bill 90 is, strategy plans are often elaborate management ballets, perfectly choreographed to do one thing, and that's to get to yes. That yes is the goal of producing a report. House Bill 190 requires long horizons that are difficult to almost impossible to measure, establishes a public comment process that doesn't encompass the practical realities of day-to-day operations in an agile and ever-changing organizational environment. Goals and targets that are truly measurable and are able to hold agency accountable, which is the intent here, can't be measured on long yearly horizons. I'm not certain about the members of the committee, but I know I can't predict what's going on in the next year, 3 years, 5 years, with any level of certainty, let alone to hold an agency to any accountability. Such models have been abandoned for good reason, because they don't answer that basic question, and the approach here is the one utilized when I took this position. I was handed a very polished report. It was very, very nice, very formatted, had a lot of long, lofty goals, but it actually informed me of nothing that was going on day-to-day in my operations. Plus, with the establishment of the interim budget committees, Montana's elected officials and our citizens now have more oversight and insight into our agency's ongoing operations and objectives on a more real-time basis than a mere report and a three-year plan could ever provide. To really determine what agencies are doing and answer that question of how we're doing, agencies need to have the ability to create one major goal or target, and then from that, short sprint objectives and measurable goals, 3 to 5 yard plays, if you will. That enables us as agency directors to pivot real time into something that's not working, often break down the components of what may be our larger strategies to drive objectives across our organizations. A really good example of something y'all have already heard me talk about the last couple of weeks is the Remote Office and Workspace Study, or ROSE. That's an enterprise-wide initiative. 2 years ago, I couldn't have outlaid that in targets and a strategic plan. It took breaking it down into small buckets and trying to figure out how to reverse engineer it and not go through a lot of bureaucratic processes, but instead work with our state employees and be very nimble to figure out what our directors needed, why should we telework, how to reduce our lease footprint, and get public comment through our state employees to Representative Mercer's point. But that was in the form of a website and a knowledge article type thing. Wasn't a formal MAPA type process, which I think most of y'all know can hang us up drastically with 30, 60, 90-day timelines at times. But now from that work, you know, that we've done with being more nimble, we've been able to determine the footprint and what we need. We still have no hard targets sometimes, but we know where we're headed, and we know what suits the businesses and our agencies. But had DFA had to utilize the processes set forth in House Bill 190, that work would have been delayed, and rather than getting to yes, we would have been focused on creating a report and then actually doing the work.
So we've been doing agile goals and objectives over the last 2 years, and we actually do submit reports to the budget office and have performance measures and objectives. So that's a little bit of a misnomer and inaccuracy there. That is a requirement by law, and we do constantly submit goals and objectives not only to the governor but to the budget office. You've probably heard from my fellow cabinet directors already about their OGSMs. For those that aren't familiar with that acronym, we always love an acronym, that stands for Objectives, Goals, Strategies, and Measures, and it is utilized by the private sector because it allows organizations to divide your aims into broad objectives, fixed and measurable goals, strategies that actually guide your actions, and measures that give you some way to monitor your progress. So rather than spending thousands of man hours and zillion of team meetings in our conference rooms to get to that yes for a report, the OGSM model is widely used because it's easy to implement. It doesn't require any special software or tools, no special consultants, 100 of man hours, or any publication of a lengthy report. It's one page. Any director in the cabinet can provide it to you. It's one page. It's our report card. Procter & Gamble is pegged with refining and championing this across the country, as well as Coca-Cola, Mars, and other major corporations use this model. We define our one big goal, and then we ask, what is the focus to get you there? The strategies and initiatives that will get you closer over that six-month horizon. We may not fully always achieve our target. Again, 3 to 5 yard plays. It's unpredictable in the agencies. Just try to move the needle and get there. These long, unmeasurable objectives that leave staff scrambling and unable to operate also leave them without a horizon or any focus. New things crop up, major initiatives are broken down, and gives us visibility on how to tackle, what to measure, what data we have, how can that be calculated, and what streamlined data processes can we improve. We are focusing not just on our metrics and widgets or lofty goals, but trying to unpack our operations and data to determine much more than that. We've changed our thinking and how agencies look at what we're going and what we're doing, but House Bill 190 will bring those valiant efforts to a screeching halt and revert back to the dog and pony days of just simply publishing a report. And that was what the model I came into when as role of director of D of A. So we're really proud of what we've accomplished over at D of A the last couple of years. I know I've got a couple of cabinet directors here that want to speak more specifically about what they've been doing and what they measure and how they work in their departments. But we really work to help drive change across our agile environments to answer that ever-important question. But the approach here will not optimize the government. It'll slow us down. It will cost state over $1 million. You saw the fiscal note. Estimated over 30,000 man hours lost where we're not focusing on our government processes and serving the citizens of Montana. And it will just revert back to an old way of doing business. So with that, I urge the committee to vote against House Bill 190.
Thank you, Director Giles. Any other opponents in the room?
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I think this is the first time I'm appearing before you. My name is Amanda Kaster, K-A-S-T-E-R, and I am the director of the Department of Natural Resources and Conservation. To build off of my colleagues' comments, I wanted to share some examples of the positive work the DNRC has been doing over the past biennium and how we've established our priorities and measured our performance. And to be clear, as the DNRC director, I know what I want the department to achieve. Since the beginning of his tenure, the governor has prioritized establishing clear goals and objectives across state agencies. He is also a very data-driven individual, as I'm sure many of you know, and he has urged the utilization of dashboards to measure performance. Further, he is incredibly focused on agencies bringing stakeholders to the table to establish shared needs and solve issues. The OGSM framework you heard from Director Giles is specifically focused on helping organizations achieve long-term goals. More verbose strategic plans often fail to connect with the day-to-day objectives. Without any ground-level execution, real success is difficult to reach. The OGSM model helps to bridge the gap by connecting business goals with delivering results. I have a few examples of how this is working at DNRC. When I became the director, the DNRC Water Division had a backlog of over 100 applications that had not been processed in 2 years. For some of the oldest applications that were waiting for department decision, some of them were over 15 years old. I repeat, 15 years old. This simply did not sit well with me, nor with the new incoming division administrator, Anna Pakenham-Stevenson. In the past 2 years, we have prioritized efficiencies and increased customer service and reduced the department-initiated backlog to zero by the end of last year. We identified this matter as a department-level measure of success, clearly laid out within our OGSM, and we were successful in meeting that goal.
Further, DNRC developed and implemented a water rights dashboard to track these applications. This resource is publicly available. It was the first time this data had been available to the public, which was a priority for me. I wanted to ensure that our stakeholders and our customers had a place to access this information, which the department previously did not have. Additionally, the DNRC set new policy, which states that the department will no longer initiate timeline waivers, and we have a deadline to process new information provided by the applicant within 90 days, thereby not allowing these department-caused backlogs to occur again. The approach we took and the work we continue to take on as it relates to water issues is very much driven by our stakeholders. About 2 years ago, we began a comprehensive review of water across the state of Montana. We brought together a diverse number of stakeholders and engaged the public to identify what our issues are and begin the process of addressing those challenges. There's one other example I'd like to share with you today. The governor has long been committed to better managing our lands. And given the forest health crisis we have in the state of Montana, the governor recognized we as a state have an opportunity to do more. So in order to achieve the broader goal of better managing our lands, he asked us to increase the pace and scale of the acres we treat using all tools available and all authorities available. So we set the measurement of our success to be 25,000 acres, which was double what the DNRC had under management status in 2020. In this case, when I refer to lands under management status, I'm referring to federal lands managed under tools like the Good Neighbor Authority, state and private partnerships, grant funds, trust lands, et cetera. We knew it was a lofty goal, since in 2020, DNRC only treated 12,000 acres, but we were committed to showing meaningful progress, and we achieved that goal. Again, we tracked our progress and success utilizing tools like dashboards. These are just two examples of the work we've done with existing resources and staff. And I believe the OGSM model has been incredibly effective in helping to establish the goals and objectives for my organization and ensure the work is actually taking place. Based on my experiences with the federal government, strategic planning efforts tend to end up being a way to list priorities without that action-oriented piece. And the focus that we're taking on is really about actually doing the work. That is exactly what I want from my department. I want to get things done. We want to get things done. We want to achieve results. So with that, Madam Chair, I thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I stand available for any questions.
Thank you, Director Castor. Any other opponents in the room?
Good morning, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, I also don't get to come and visit you often. So my name is Chris Dorrington, D-O-R-R-I-N-G-T-O-N, and I'm the director at the Department of Environmental Quality. And today I rise in opposition to the bill. And I preface this by saying, I just don't disagree with what Representative Mercer is trying to do. Good government is good for everyone, and man, do we pour ourselves into this. So I became director in January of 2021, and I came from the agency. I was unique among some of the appointments because I'd grown up in state government. I was in private industry before that, but I'd spent a lot of time in transportation. I've watched how you can and cannot move an entire culture. I then joined DEQ 4.5 years in Air Energy and Mining Division Administrator, and then became director. I had an idea how to do that. It's not simple. What I align with 100% is that our agency makes commitments. We make those transparent. We make them known. So you guys know, the public knows. Next, you have feedback. So we follow the MAPA compliant process on everything that we do right now. It's laborious right now, and it's also incredibly valuable. Your roles right here are laborious and incredibly valuable. Then report on them. So we have make it known. Make a commitment, make it known. Feedback, report on them. And then move culture. Move agency culture, state government performance forward. Make it accountable. We align. 100% align with that. In the example that Representative Mercer gave you in his role, I have tremendous respect for you. Look at your caseload. Is that comparable to other caseloads? Are the examples similar? Then you develop a plan. But with respect, it's not a strategic plan that he described. It's a data collection process and a tactical action plan that achieved his outcome. And I think it's great. We can totally do that. I've been a part of quite a handful of starts and stops, and I was one of the ones that had the unlucky and unfortunate opportunity to stand before him and say, you know, when he said, did you do what is laid out? And do you have a strategic plan? Have you made commitments? And I, no, I really don't think we have. It's not that the state government agency isn't working really hard to accomplish a lot of things. And all of you serve on all sorts of other committees. I know you do because I get to see you in the other places. Those policy committees set forth law that we must satisfy. And most of the stuff that we do has timelines already established, some of which we are good at very consistently doing and some of which we're not. One area we are not, or had not, I say past tense because we're on track now, not done well on, is subdivision permitting approvals. 2020 through, I'll say July of 2022, so mid-year 2020 to mid-year 2022, we did not do well in the face of in record applications, in the face of 92% turnover in staff, in the face of limited leadership, in the face of almost no use of technology. We did poorly. In July of 2022, I set up an incident management team response. 700 plus hours of additional resources poured into improving technology, hiring well, teaching and training consistent process, communicating and training that process to, honestly, a group of consultants and engineers that are not that great at it. They're doing better. We're on time. Christmas present, zero backlog. We started in July at 490 files backlog due. In 6 months, I turned that entire thing to a positive. Can we sustain it? Yes, because of the things I identified. Would have a strategic plan adjusted anything? Absolutely not. Because 2 years ago, I would have said, our agency is committed to on-time defensible permitting. It would not have anticipated record workload, record turnover in one section, leadership that wasn't fit for the roles they were set for, and poor use of technology. A strategic plan would not have addressed anything but a bullet saying, let's deliver permits on time. We failed for 2 years almost. What did change that was an incident management team approach that said a collection of data. Where are we? They didn't even know the program. And I'm pulling back the curtain and telling you facts that I think I'm trying to be as transparent as possible. You expect me to be honest. I'm telling you what's going on. The program could not tell me how many files by reviewer were coming in from what localities and what was necessary in order to achieve on-time defensible permitting. A strategic plan would have done nothing to solve any of that. Data collection, a tactical action plan, in the example, fit to the example that Representative Mercer gave you, we solved it. What will it take to continue that? A strategic plan will not do anything in order to keep us on track with on-time defensible permitting for subdivisions. Instead, ongoing data collection. So I go back to what I think you're trying to achieve. Commitments. We will maintain zero backlog in subdivisions. How will we do that? Because I'm watching it every day. I'm reporting it every single week. The program sends me an email. Here's where we're at. And I can show you. This is a chart from yesterday. Orange is bad. Blue is good. Orange goes to zero, blue gets bigger. And I see this once a week. A strategic plan would do nothing to achieve that. And this is my point. In order for us to be responsive to challenges that we do not anticipate coming, who would have known COVID was coming? A strategic plan would have done nothing with that. Who would have known that COVID then would incite record movement and requirement for housing to Montana? A strategic plan would have not solved that. Data collection, clear and consistent systems and technology that support that data collection and report out in dashboards, transparent to all. Trust me, I have told and shown this to lots of people. Why? Because the whole system worked from July to December. I want you guys to know, one, full admission, we didn't do well. Two, full admission that we're on it now, and I will show you daily, if you want to, where we're at, by reviewer, by person that works for me. What is missing, I think, in the strategic plan ask, and again, I'm committed to strong government. I'm committed to transparency, data collection, and investment in systems that report it. Could we do better? 100%. Could we do better reporting it, collecting it, showing you, teaching, training? I mean, if I said right now, let me just pick another graph in here. That I shared this with the budget subcommittee, so not prompted by a strategic plan ask, but the other director shared, there's my objective, goals, strategies, and measures. It's a one-pager for 2 years. And let me just highlight a couple things that I think are relevant that you guys should know. Another example, in January 2021, when I became director, I said, here is the metric, the metric, the number one thing that we're going to do. We're no longer going to sit and wait for a phone call. No longer will my agency sit. If we know something's coming, we're going to do proactive outbound, what I call touches. And touches can be a phone call, a meeting, you name it, an email, albeit I don't love that. In person, over the phone, talk through something. So I set a goal, 10 per person per month. It's pretty doable. I have 400 employees. My target then, ish, my target is 4,000 proactive outbound touches a month. This is number one, the goal. You think, how do you get to simple? I want everybody to be proactive. It changes everything. I want us to communicate. It changes everything. There's our goal. Tracked over time, proactive outbound touches. My goal for 2022 was 45,600 touches. Proactive, unsolicited. So we're not just waiting. What did we hit? 57,783. I went over by 12,000. We're now on track right now. This is the culture shift. We're now on track to do 5,000 a month. My ask was 3,800. My people now know, because I trained it into the agency, what do we expect? This. How? I taught them how. Then we do it. So my goal in this that I reported to my budget subcommittee yesterday, my goal for the forward-looking biennium, in which I have a one-pager, is 100,000 proactive outbound touches in 2 years. And we're going to do it. I'm certain we're going to come in at 120. Is that unique? Yes. Representative Schillinger told me last night, he said, if I would tell anybody that your agency is making 60,000 proactive outbound touches in a year, they wouldn't believe you, except for the individual stories that are coming in. Holy cow, you called me. You saw a problem coming in, you called me. A strategic plan would not have generated this. It's data collection, a tactical action plan, and then accountability. So looking at my OGSM, very simple, objective, goals, strategies, measures. And I'll point out, it's also keywords that Representative Mercer used in his strategic plan objective. Customer service. I'm going to teach and train leaders how to perform customer service. Proactive outbound touches. eGov, which is our electronic initiative to improve the handshake with citizens and stakeholders. I have systems in the queue that will have already been delivered, but to improve upon the relationship and the transparency and reporting of exactly what we're asking for right now. Red tape reduction and regulatory reform. I have a chart right now that I just reported. The last one in my group. The DEQ reform metrics to date. This gets updated every 2 weeks. What rules, statutes, regulations have we looked at? Are we moving? What priority are they? We meet regularly. We're doing the work. The last one I'll just touch on because I see you guys are waxing a little bit on how happy I am about how well we're doing. I mean it. I live this. I breathe it. I want my agency to do well. Okay, so last, I call them rocks. Over the course of time, my agency has just collected rocks. They put them in the backpack. Long-term difficult projects, communities that need attention. We put them in our backpack and we say, man, that's hard. So we take two more steps, we throw another rock in the backpack. Man, that one's hard. That one's going to take a lot of meetings, a lot of conversation. No kidding. Take the rock out and take a chip off of that. Have a conversation, move little bits forward so that Butte, Libby, Colstrip, you name a community, we have forward progress. And that's the ask. So we move rocks, we make proactive outbound touches, we deal with customer service on a daily basis. My office is more transparent and more open, available to meetings than anyone has said in the past. And that's not a dig on past directors. The other piece that I think you're shooting for, Representative, is culture shift. So people ask me, do you have an environmental agenda? I don't. I'm the director of an agency. I do not have an environmental agenda. What I want is a really strong agency that follows and implements the law. And we do that with the best customer service, the greatest attention, improved clarity, and clear, consistent, well-communicated, based in common sense, because we can get a little nerdy, based in common sense approaches. And no strategic plan is going to make us do that. Data collection, tactical action plans. These are 6 months. This is a two-year plan, but we do it in 6 months. We report it out. And then we have systems, investment in technology to make all of it better. With that, I just vote personally no on this one. I urge the same of you. Thanks, and I'll sit for questions.
Thank you, Director Dorrington. Any other opponents in the room? Any other opponents? Opponents online?
No, Madam Chair.
Moving on, informational witnesses.
Chair Dooling, committee members, my name is Adam Carpenter. I am the chief data officer for the state. I've got years of experience in the private sector helping organizations produce strategic plans, go through the data maturity journey, and get to where they're using meaningful metrics to drive the business. And I'm available for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Carpenter. Any other informational witnesses? Any other informational witnesses? Seeing none. Questions from the committee? Representative Baum.
Madam Chair, for Mr. Borrington, am I saying that correctly? Dorrington, sorry.
Representative Baum, Director Dorrington.
Madam Chair, Representative Baum.
Didn't quite wax over, so that was very informative. Thank you.
Oh, good. Thank you. one vote, yes.
With the proposed bill, how would this, it sounds like you laid out a very good understanding of what your particular agency is doing. Mm-hmm. Do you see any potential restrictions that the proposed bill would restrict what you're doing currently?
Madam Chair, Representative Baum, it's a great question, and thank you. Here's what I think. I have an agency that has 260 scientists, probably 50-ish in engineers, financial people and support individuals. They don't come with a strategic planning background, but the requirement of the bill would ask that leaders and staff spend time on a strategic plan. I'm going to take them out of their core duties. What I've told other committees, and now you get it. Thanks for the question. Now I get a wax wise on something else. The litigation workload on us is really heavy. And what I keep saying is litigation, we have attorneys in the agency and they work really hard to defend our decisions. What is not known is that we also require our scientists and engineers to support all of those materials. As soon as we're litigated, we need to support, we have depositional testimony, support materials, lots of support materials in order to defend a decision. My worry with this is that we won't do more, but I'll take more time away from them in the core duties that they're powerful in and that we hire and pay them to do. So that would be.
Follow up, Madam Chair?
Follow up.
Dorrington, so is there possible unanticipated fiscal note or expenses because of additional duties taking you from your core work? Does that make sense?
Yeah, sure. Madam Chair, Representative Pond, You're fit to the task here. So the other pieces is there unintended consequences or indirect impacts? Absolutely. I think we tried to do our best in saying, to create a strategic plan, here's what we would take. And, you know, FTE time and energy and a systems approach, I think it would cost, with respect, I think all state agencies, I think the fiscal note is on. The piece that I wouldn't capture here is the spirit of our staff. So I'm running at 18% vacancies, 16 to 20 for last year. If I ask them, okay, now I'm going to add a strategic planning duty, and I wouldn't say everyone needs to do it, right? But key individuals who I really count on for all the other work, if I said, okay, now we're going to do strategic planning too, I think they're going to be broken in spirit, honestly. And I'm not saying this is the camel that breaks their back, but it's going to be another duty that they didn't really want to be saddled with. I went through school. I'm an engineer by training. I think these people come out of school and want to do work in science and engineering. And if I say, hey, why don't you do some strategic planning too? They're going to say, another thing where I'm not trained and I don't really want to. So will they do it? Heck yeah, my agency responds.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you, Director Dorrington. Representative Staffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question for the sponsor.
Representative Staffman, Representative Mercer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Staffman.
Representative Mercer, you know, we've got, and I think we've just passed a bill to expand and extend the MARA committee that Representative Jones runs, which is a sort of planning committee. And we also have in the Appropriations Committee a long-term planning section, I believe. I'm wondering if you think that there's some duplication of efforts to require strategic plans of agencies when those other committees are also looking at least aspects of those strategic plans. Madam Chair.
Yeah, thanks, Madam Chair and Representative Staffman. Thanks for the question. I'm on the MARA committee. So what I think I can tell you about MARA is I never remember exactly. It's modernization and something. We're looking, I think it's modernization and risk. I forget what assessment or something, whatever they are, analysis, thank you. It's really designed to get our arms around data. We're trying to look at data sets. We're trying to look at models. We are not trying to think strategically about how various components of state government are doing what they're doing. That's, again, that I'm not trying to divest the executive branch of its role to say this is what we are trying to implement. So I don't think MARA would have any overlap here. I mean, we might be looking at data, but we're not a policy committee, right? We're a data committee. We're an extension of the LFC. I'm not sure what your long range, if you're talking about the IBCs, which we just, that bill just went to the Senate to remove the sunset on the IBCs. I think it was Director Giles who mentioned, no, actually it was, I think it was Director Castor who mentioned the IBCs. The IBCs are really there to do oversight work on the budget. And so they are, they certainly are doing oversight, but they're not on a, they're not policy committees, and they're not looking at everything that the agency is trying to do and saying, you know, what was your intention here? How's that going? What have you done? So no, I basically the straight answer is I don't think the legislature can take over the execution role and the implementation role and the assessment role. We can be involved in trying to understand it as we do our work, but I don't think that's our task, frankly.
Follow up. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, unlike organizations in the private sector, our state agencies are very dependent on the funding that they don't get to control, we do. Don't you think there are extra challenges in trying to prepare strategic plans when you don't know what your funding is going to be beyond a biennium?
Madam Chair, Representative Staffman, I guess the tension in the argument here, as I was trying to say in my opening, on the one hand, you've heard OGSM is great. It is fully dispositive of the question of whether we're managing effectively. So I guess I'd come back to you and say, if first thing you got to ask yourself is, Does any legislator you know from any, you were chair of public health, do you know what the OGSM is for the Department of Public Health? Was that ever something that got briefed to you? Ask your members on the IBC committees if they know what the OGSM is for their sections. The OGSM process is, in my estimation, is an internal executive branch process that nobody has any idea what it is, except for people in the executive branch. The legislature doesn't know. The public doesn't know. Do a Google search when you walk out of the committee room. Put in OGSM Montana. See how many agencies you find with anything that's listed there. So the tension is, on the one hand, you're hearing, we've got this under control. We're doing a great job with OGSM. You don't need to do anything. Then you're hearing it's going to be really expensive to do a strategic plan. I think, you know, we really should try to figure out a way to marry this effort up. If you have a process that is trying to, OGSM stands for Objective Goal Strategy and Measurement. If that's your process as an agency, is there a way that we could say for every one of your programs, tell us what your objectives are, your goals are, your strategies are, and what your performance measurements are going to be for those? That's what this bill does. This is saying we want to institutionalize OGSM. So I hope I answered the question. Do I think that they have the money to do it? They say they're doing it already.
A follow-up? Just going to clarify my question, if I might.
Follow-up.
Yeah, when I said the money, I'm talking about their operations. So if you take HHS, for example, they've got a variety of programs, each one of which could be funded next time or might not. I'll give you an example. The 988 line that we've set up, it's got funding through the end of this year. There's no guarantee they'll be funded past there. If they're trying to set up a strategy on a long-term and a strategic plan on crisis services that includes 988, don't you think there are some big impediments when you don't get to control the purse?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair and Representative Staffman, you're right. I didn't understand the question. I guess I would say if the strategic plan adopted in September of 23 for 988, if there's something there that says this is our objective, these are our output and our outcome measures for that program. If that program doesn't get funded by the legislature in 2025, then obviously no one is going to hold an agency accountable for something that we didn't fund. I don't know why they couldn't do that planning now. Could that become irrelevant depending on what we do with future appropriations? Yes. But the idea that the strategic plan and the performance measures can't be nimble, I think that's wrong. I think the bill contemplates that an agency can change. If they say we've got the mix wrong, we want to establish something different on a performance measure, that's within their authority. And if you want to exempt the public comment, if you want to say anytime they want to do a midstream revision, we're not going to put that up for public comment, I'd accept that as a friendly amendment too.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you, Representative Mercer. Representative Walsh was next.
Madam Chair, question for Representative Mercer, please.
Representative Mercer.
Madam Chair, Representative Walsh.
Yes, the question I have, how does the legislative auditor fit into this whole process? I mean, part of their thing is actually numbers and those type of things. The other part of their responsibilities is performance, that an agency is doing what the legislature asked them to do. Are we kind of duplicating the effort here, or is the legislative auditor not maybe performing or doing that?
Madam Chair and Representative Walsh, I think it's a great question. I would say the answer to the question is the audit division does program evaluations. I think many of us look at those and use them in terms of the work that we're doing. It is not something where they don't have the resources to comprehensively evaluate every single program within the state government. They have to, you know, the audit committee decides what they want to audit. They do program evaluations. I don't know. I'm sure Mr. McKeever could tell you how many they do a year. But they don't have the ability to say, we're going to look at, it's not like a financial audit. They're not going to look at every program that's being administered by an agency. So I think the bill would actually help the audit division considerably, because I think the bill would say, we know as an audit division what it is that the agency said that it wanted in the way of goals, objectives, outputs, outcomes, and performance measures. It would essentially put on the board, this is where we want to go with this program. This is what we want to achieve. And to the extent that the audit division and the committee says we want to evaluate that program, then there's more clarity in terms of what the agency wanted to achieve in the first place. So I think it would enhance the work that the audit division does. Not. I don't think it would duplicate it, and I don't think it would undercut it.
Follow-up?
So not that I'm involved in that, that legislative oversight, but isn't that what the Legislative Audit Committee is directed by legislators to do that performance? You are part of that performance evaluation, part of their task. So is it then are we getting away from, it's the mandate that the legislature is telling what the departments are doing. So we're not separating that, because the auditors are looking from the legislative point of view, and so then they wouldn't necessarily need to be looking at what Mr. Dorrington does over at DQ as far as their strategic plan. Am I confusing the issue, or
I'm not, Madam Chair, Representative Walsh. I don't know if I do understand the question.
But what I'm saying is that the legislative auditors are directed by the legislator. And so we're having them go into the DEQ and say, are you performing the way that we want you to perform? That's my concept of what the process is currently, or should be, I think. And so what's that have to do with strategic planning and those type of things? So now we're getting the auditor into strategic planning also.
Madam Chair, Representative Walsh, I guess I don't want to speak for Mr. McKeever. I think Mr. McKeever would say that the audit, the program evaluation function that he does is an ad hoc thing. I don't know if they do more than, say, 15 or 20 a year. And it's when the committee says, hey, we want to go look at that program. By its very nature, there are only so many programs they can review at a particular time. They're trying to look at effectiveness of programs. That's true, but I don't think it overtakes anything that the bill's trying to do. The bill's trying to say, we want the executive branch for all of its programs, for everything it does, to say this is what we want to achieve. Mr. McKeever is going to go in. Maybe he goes in and says, I've had comments made about the permitting backlog at DNRC that Director Castor talked about. I want to run a team in there, and I want to see that. I want to see when the backlog started. I want to see when it ended. I want to see what it took to get it done. I want to study that. Well, that would be one tiny little thing that DNRC does, and that would take up one audit. And if he's doing 20 a year of program evaluations, it shows you how vast state government is and how little actually gets evaluated on the back end. And it's not transforming the executive branch.
Thank you, Representative Mercer. Representative Yakowich.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question for the sponsor.
Representative Mercer.
Mr. Mercer, I know you put a lot, Representative Mercer, Madam Chair, you put a lot into this. I appreciate. I wanted to visit you from another angle. I can see the value in city council where we have done strategic planning or in my other work. And I'm asking you the question in terms of as a new legislator, that these kind of strategic plans, would they be helpful for us to understand them as we are holding these agencies accountable, whether through funding or implementing bills? So I'm seeing this as a way of educating and helping us as legislators go through the process over the years. Could you address that?
Yeah, Madam Chair and Representative Yakovitch, I really think you're absolutely right. I think that if you could pick up a document and say, I have in one document a summary of every program that the agency in question is administering, and I know what it is that they are attempting to achieve, and I know how they're going to measure whether they have achieved what they want to achieve, it would be a one-stop shop in terms of what it is that we're funding, what it is that they are doing with the resources. And frankly, you could look for gaps. You could say, you know, there was some bill 10 years ago that attempted to do this. I don't even see it on this page. Does it mean that that's not something that's prioritized anymore? And I, as an appropriator, I will tell you that if you give us a quiz on every single program that is run by departments under a particular section of the budget, I think you'd find that a lot of us don't understand down to the program level what it is that's being done. And so, yeah, this whole exercise would be helpful in the first instance for the executive branch to clearly state what it's trying to do, how it's going to measure it, how it's going to know whether it's been successful or not. But, of course, it would help us because then we'd have more clarity in terms of what it is that they're trying to do and achieve.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Mercer.
Thank you, Representative Mercer and Representative Yakovitch. Any other questions from the committee? Well, Representative Mercer, would you like to close on your bill?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And I think I covered some of this in responding to Mr. Representative Staffman's question, but at the risk of duplication, I guess I want to start where I think I either started or ended up in my opening, which is to say, let me take you back to that public health statute that I read. Keep in mind that Governor Martz signed that bill, and then Governor Schweitzer got elected, and according to what DPHHS is telling me, is that never was there any work done on outcomes, outputs, or performance measures. Then Governor Bullock was elected, the department, same thing. I've asked for this. No one can give me anything that's required by the statute. And now we've been in this administration for 2 years, and I can't tell you that we have outcomes, outputs, or performance measures for all the programs in DPHHS as required by the statute. On the other hand, you've heard a lot of testimony today from people that are in the executive branch who say, we really are doing some very important work on OGSM. And, you know, we're on the right track. And I guess what I really would hope you would say is, what separates what it is that we're trying to do in the bill with what the executive branch says it's doing right now? Why? What is it in this bill that is so problematic that we can't have a marriage of the concepts? And to me, what it is transparency. I can't believe that anyone here or anyone down in the appropriations committees could say with clarity, we know exactly what the objectives and the goals and the outcomes and the outputs and the performance measures that any department, pick one, any department wants to achieve in this upcoming biennium, and the performance measures that would be in place that would allow us to look back. So I think the whole goal here would be to say, we're not trying to do this for the present or the past. We're trying to say, where are we going to be in 10 years? And I would really encourage you to answer this question. Can an initiative that is being undertaken by one executive branch, by fiat, not by statute, not by rule, but by fiat, transform state government? Or would we be back here in 8 years, or whenever this administration is done, would we be back here and would we be saying, the good work that was described in 2023 on OGSM has completely been lost because it was being done by executive fiat and it didn't serve to transform state government at all? There is no change in the culture. I agree with Director Dorrington. I'm looking for a cultural shift. I want the accountability, transparency, and sort of visioning approach that will take us in a better direction for the out years. And that's why I keep saying, try not to personalize this. Try to say, how do we look back when it's 2036 and say, thank goodness that we did something in 2023? Because I think if we just say, let's let this run its course. It's going to look a lot like the statute that they passed in 2003 that got ignored for 20 years. So, obviously, I'm happy to answer any questions you've got before you take executive action, but thanks for the good hearing, and appreciate your consideration of the bill. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Mercer. This now closes the hearing on House Bill 190. Folks, we still have one more bill to hear. So as soon as the room clears out a bit, we'll have the good Representative Brockman present his bill. We will now hear House Bill 199, sponsored by Representative Brockman. Please open on your bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. We survived our first hostage experience with Representative Mercer. We did it together. It was a bonding experience. We should all be proud of ourselves. He's my adjacent seatmate. Good gosh, hello. Let me begin over. For the record, I am Tony Brockman. That is spelled B-R-O-C-K-M-A-N. I represent House District 9. That is North Kalispell and the community of Evergreen. I bring before you today House Bill 199, requested by the Governor's Office of Economic Development. The Governor's Office of Economic Development targets business retention, recruitment, workforce development, technology development, infrastructure, improvement, and permitting and regulatory processes for the state of Montana. House Bill 199 renames the Chief Business Development Officer to the Chief Economic Development Officer and clarifies roles and responsibilities. Simple bill. Madam Chair, with that, I will sit down and let the governor's chief of staff provide the specifics of the bill.
Thank you, Representative Brockman. Any proponents to House Bill 199?
Yes, Madam Chair. My name is Chris Hegem, H-E-G-G-E-M. I'm chief of staff for the governor. Pleased to be before you today and plan to make this very short and sweet. This bill is an outgrowth of a conversation that I had when I testified before the Economic Affairs Interim Committee last June. At that time, I talked about the format of the Governor's Office of Economic Development and how we had transformed it somewhat from its previous iteration to match our priorities, this governor's priorities, and we have now placed field staff around the state. We recently hired a director of this office. You may have heard of him. His name is Mark Blaisdell. He was very busy today testifying on tax bills. So I got to the great honor of following Bill Mercer. And so the conversation at that time, when I talked to Economic Affairs Interim Committee, I talked about how there's been some change in format because, first of all, we're doing slightly different work in the Governor's Office of Economic Development, although we still have the same goals, and we're still working on workforce development, infrastructure development. But one thing has changed since this bill originally passed, and that is in the last legislature, we're grateful that the legislature funded the Office of Business Attraction within the Commerce Department. And our current Director of Commerce, Mr. Scott Osterman, who I'm sure many of you know, he has been charged with the governor to be the Chief Business Development Officer. And this statute acts, the existing statute that we're amending today, that I hope you will amend, allows for some flexibility. And it says that the head of the Governor's Office of Economic Development may be the head of business attraction, but is not required to be. So in my mind, it allows for more flexibility as time passes, as challenges change, to allow the governor's office and the Office of Economic Development to address the needs of Montanans. So with that, I would be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Hagem. Any other proponents to House Bill 199? I don't see that we have any online. Do we have any opponents to House Bill 199 in the room? And there's none online. So we're going to informational witnesses. Seeing none, questions from the committee. Questions from the committee. Don't see any of those either. So Representative Brockman, would you like to close on your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for the quick, efficient hearing. actually, I think we can thank Representative Bill Mercer for that. Economic development is critical to our state's growth, strength, and vitality. House Bill 199 is a small step in ensuring that that goal is met. I ask for a due pass. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Brockman. This now closes the hearing on House Bill 199. Okay, so tomorrow we have two bills up. That's House Bill 206 and 210. If we decide to do executive action, we'll go through and decide that list and then have a break and go from there. That's okay with everyone. 206 and what? 210? And then Thursday, we have some fiscal note training and a special district presentation. And I believe, I know I sent the email out, and I hope you all got it and read it. So I think with that, we are going to adjourn for today. Thanks, everyone, for hanging in there.